Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, now available on demand and through Shudder. Jenna's enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her assailants, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent, revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film. Now available through Shudder and most on-demand streaming platforms. I like it a lot.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. They just released a brand new line of Chucky trading cards. The first collection of Cabin in the Woods shirts and pins are now available, and the collection has three awesome Cabin in the Woods shirts as well as five enamel pins, which are the various monsters from the film. And on July 4th, Fright Rags will be releasing a whole new Jaws collection. And if you look back at the Shockwaves team picks from Texas Frightmare, you will see the entire crew wearing Fright Rags shirts. We love them. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Go to www.fright-rags.com now.
The Shockwaves crew is super excited that we are heading to Mad Monster Party in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th to 15th at the Weekapaw Resort just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team will be there doing a live show. Check it out at madmonster.com. Head there for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. While there, be sure to touch Elric's face. Just touch it.
Mitch Pileggi, the Shocker, will be there. So the actual Shocker will be there with Shockwaves. How cool is that? I'm so excited about that.
Mad Monster Party, July.
I can't guarantee he'll be on our show. No, that's a pretty good idea.
That is.
Okay, and welcome to episode 101 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo.
Hey there.
Hey.
We survived.
We survived 100. Not to 240 if we want to get technical.
And then how ironic that today it's back to killer POV days.
Straight back.
Well, that's Elric Kane right there.
That's me.
Absent is Ryan Turek.
Yep. He has left us.
He left us again.
This was all just a giant 100-episode tease to drop the Halloween trailer. That's my theory. It was like, I got to do a little promo. Yeah. I'm going to put in the legwork, and then I'm gone.
And now that he's gone, we could talk about it. But also, right. Rebecca McKendry is here.
Hey, guys.
So
how's it going?
It's the trio of the four.
Yeah. And
listened to 100. It was good.
Yeah.
Listened
to four.
I think that's the first full one I've listened to every beat of that I was on.
I can't do it. I try.
I've listened to some that when Rob interviewed the Fender Bender
director.
That was
when you're not on it, it's easier.
It's just like a normal podcast.
Oh, no. The ones that I'm not on, I'll usually catch just to see how much Kane makes fun of me in some capacity.
Right.
I noticed I talked
tune
a lot.
In for that.
I was like, wow, I'm talking a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Which, yes, this is your thing, though.
Yeah. It goes back to the same old, it's annoying to listen to yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Well, now that we're 100 in, it's exciting because we're going to mix it up from here on out. I mean, you'll get the same show, but for example, I'm really excited about our guest today, and I'll gush about him now before he's here, so it's not to his face.
Cool.
But it's I guess you can call him a radio DJ, but he's a musician and a music producer named Christian James Hand. I met him through my roommate about 2 years ago, and he does this incredible show called The Session on Air. It's on 95.5 here in Los Angeles, and I think you can go to the website 95.5. And basically what he does is, in both a very educational and comical way, he will take the original elements of a song and literally break it apart instrument by instrument. So he does it live once a month here in Los Angeles and every Monday morning, truncated version on the radio. Where what I mean by that is you'll hear a couple seconds of Beat It by Michael Jackson, for example, and then he'll play just the drum part so you can hear what that sounds like isolated. And then the drums and the bass, which he calls the engine room, so you can hear how the song is kind of constructed and put together. And hearing it that way, you'll never hear the song the same way again. Mm-hmm. You're like, wow, that guitar part and Beat It is pretty darn good, you know? But it just makes me appreciate, you know, obviously, besides horror, music is one of my big passions. And I was douchey enough to even say, hey, man, you play birthday parties? So he played my birthday party last year.
Which was really cool.
You were saying he did some 90s stuff, Soundgarden, Spoon Man, which you said you can't hear the same way.
Yeah, I was telling Rob in the kitchen before we started tonight that after watching him do, he literally broke down Spoon Man, all of the different parts.
Yeah.
And the very first thing that he starts with is the drums. And there is so much percussion in that song.
And spoons.
None of which I'd ever paid attention to. Because I'm listening to Chris Cornell and just kind of getting dreamy on his awesome voice.
Yes, it is.
And then
awesome.
This amazing drum stuff in there, and it's like it's all over the place. Like does not make sense with the song, but it's fucking wild and amazing. And so I cannot hear that song now without just listening to the drums.
And it was great because we actually had I don't think you made it to that org.
No,
we actually had because we were doing it outside. The cops were called on us.
Oh,
which was wonderful.
Well, it was
Scott Reynolds. Well, to deal with that.
It was hilarious because there was a cop in the background while he was playing an Audio Slave song. We were like, well, you got to hear his voice here. And then the cop's like, you guys playing Audio Slave? Like, he was kind of like into it. He wanted to stay. He's like, this is actually really cool, but could you keep it down just a little bit? So anyway, Christian's going to be here later today, and I found the perfect way to segue horror and music, and it is a piece of music that everyone that listens to the show absolutely knows the second they hear it, but I guarantee you don't know the story behind it, and it's incredible. It's going to blow minds, and it's going to be awesome, so I can't wait for that.
And that song is Phil Collins's I Can Feel It coming in the air tonight, which I'm going to ask our guest, because you remember my dream? I don't know if I told you. My dream was to take that song by Phil Collins and have somebody edit it into clips of Halloween and perfectly match it so it feels, because I feel like if you listen to that song, it has similarities to the actual Halloween theme.
All right, bring that up when he's here. Because you do know that Phil Collins is his favorite musician of all time.
Are you serious?
And we can be friends.
Elric's fucking with you. That's not the song that they're going to break down.
But what?
I have this wonderful picture.
Why am I here, Becca?
Of my daughter. When that, I have Sirius XM, and so it plays through my television. Uh-huh. And when that comes on, this giant floating picture, like floating head of Phil Collins fills the frame.
So cool.
And the song is creepy, and I have a picture of my daughter hiding behind the couch from Phil Collins' giant floating head while that song is playing.
All right, listen, we'll see.
We'll talk about that on air, then. Let's see what he thinks about this idea.
Let's see how many times he drops Phil Collins in his lecture, because he does it every time.
And he's the best drummer to ever live.
Yes, that's
Phil
true.
Phil Collins is like the greatest musician that I never paid attention to.
Don't say that
apparently.
In front of Don't say it in front of Christian. He'll actually judge you.
Harshly.
Then I am
Phil
good
Collins
today.
I'm
sitting pretty for today.
Wow.
All right, well, lots to talk about. First and foremost, hey, that Halloween trailer finally dropped.
Hey!
Go figure.
I think Ryan did it just because he was sick of people poking him on Twitter about it. Like, he pushed to get it.
That was pretty brutal for him.
Or maybe they had a plan all along to release it in June. Look, I'm all in. I mean, I'm not... Ryan's my friend, obviously, and I'm happy that he's got such a big part of it. But I guess to me... I mean, because I've never seen a fan base as ravenous for any horror franchise as they are for Halloween.
Oh my gosh.
People are insane about Michael Myers at Halloween. And I think one of the biggest critiques was how, they're not going to pay attention to the other movies.
They're ignoring the sequels.
I don't care. I mean, that's fine. Those movies exist. Nothing's going to wipe them out. But to me, when I saw that trailer, and we may have seen it before it actually dropped,
maybe
10 seconds before, I don't know. But when I had first seen it, my initial reaction is like, okay, so there's this movie from 1978 called Halloween that we all arguably say is one of the greatest horror movies of all time. Like, we love it. And now somebody's saying, hey, remember that movie that we all agree is a masterpiece? We're just going to make one that takes place right after that.
Yep.
And I'm kind of like, all right, cool. Yeah, that sounds great. I want to see that. And the other thing, not to knock any of the directors that did the sequels, because I love them all and they've done interesting work, but it's kind of like, you know, David Gordon Green to me is like, not Pineapple Express. I love that movie. Don't get me wrong, but he's a real director.
Yeah.
Like, with a lot of it's going to be interesting to see him tackle that stuff. And I just want a straightforward.
Grounded, yeah. Like it looked like they'd grounded it in drama, you know. And what I liked about it was the part that got me excited because when he first started showing it to us.
Because you don't watch trailers. So this is exciting that you watched this one.
And this, I was so curious, you know what I mean? And it was also interesting because it was a week after the Suspiria trailer, which looked fantastic.
But
David Gordon Green was signed for years to direct that.
Suspiria.
And I'm really glad he didn't because I think having an Italian make that is fantastic.
Right. Like,
whatever happens, it's fantastic.
And it seems like he got a Suspiria homage into the whole sequence in the trailer, the whatchamacallit, the jail cell thing.
Oh, yeah.
That looks totally Suspiria.
Yeah. No, so, but it's, I mean, you're right. David Gordon Green's, his early films especially are really great dramas. But no, watching it, I really liked, like, as soon as I saw Jamie Lee Curtis and her, like, training and practicing, it felt very now. It felt very topical. It felt like, I don't know, I suddenly was like, yeah, that's the heroine I want.
Yeah,
I don't need another final girl who's just 18 and just, like, somehow has ninja skills. That doesn't really, it's not what I need right now. You know, it's seeing somebody who has a reason to feel this way, a reason for 40 years, is pretty exciting. So I think it looks cool.
Jamie Lee is totally playing it up, and I don't know if you saw it, but she tweeted and Instagrammed a photo of her as Laurie Strode in the new Halloween next to Patti Smith, and they look identical, and she's like, Laurie Strode is punk as fuck.
Yes.
And I was like, that is pretty exceptional.
Really, it was good.
What do you think about, because you're not really a slasher person.
I
like Halloween, the original.
I do love the original, and I was actually kind of, I don't want to say happy because the fans will get upset, but I completely understand why they decided not to use all of the sequels, because it in a way, you know, some people consider it canon, but at the same time, there's elements that you might not want to include. You know, what you love is the original, and so I completely get it. If somebody, God willing, came to me and said, hey, do you want to do a Hellraiser? I wouldn't suddenly go like, well, all whatever number of films they're up to now are canon, so I have to include every element of those.
No, with Hellraiser, I feel like the first two films are a myth, and after that, it's all sorts of stuff. Like, you could break
apart. It gets kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
There was a lot of good trailers last week, because, like, we mentioned the Suspiria trailer, which I am totally into and will be
I love that trailer. It's
opening.
A great
Someone actually
trailer.
Cut the original Goblin theme to that new
I gotta
trailer.
Watch that version.
Oh my gosh.
Actually, it's pretty cool.
And I doubt anybody saw this one because it didn't get nearly as much attention as the other two, but Down a Dark Hall. Are you guys even?
No, I never even heard of this one.
So this one, it's based off a Lois Duncan horror book from 1974. And the movie, I was trying to look up when it comes out. I am so excited that they are doing a movie version of it. And it stars Uma Thurman, Isabel Furman. I am really excited. This is a Lionsgate film. It comes
August
out
17th.
August 17th. I'm really excited to see what they do with this. I loved the book so much when I was a kid. And the guy who is directing it did the 2010 film Buried, which I really liked.
That's a good film.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm Ryan excited Reynolds to see what coffin. He does with this. So that was another trailer which got kind of buried underneath the Suspiria and the Halloween trailers, but I'm excited to check this one out.
Speaking of trailers,
yeah,
who would have thought? I also thought the Von Trier thriller trailer for House That Jack Built looked really badass.
Oh, I haven't watched that yet, but I've been hearing all the buzz.
It was great because this is where me and modern journalism break ties. All the articles after it played, they all said in the title, mass walkouts of new Von Trier film.
Yep.
And then you read the article. You read the same article and it says there is a number of people walking out. And at the end of the film, there is a lot of people standing ovations. And you're like, that's not in the fucking article. You guys are pieces of shit. Sorry. Like the way you you're right.
You know? Like right after Raw started doing its festival run, all of the articles were immediately like people walk out of French film. And when I saw it, I think one person walked out. And,
That film makes sense because there's a squeamish quality. But I just hate that kind of like, oh, we got to grab headlines. We'll report the whole part. Like, I'm sure it's going to be shocking. But the trailer was intense. You just remind me because you said Uma Thurman and it looks like some bad violence happens to her in that film. But I think it'll be an interesting film. I'm very curious.
It feels very contemporary Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. And so it's a film that I can't wait to see it. I'm not going to enjoy it and I will never watch it again. But I have to see it.
And finally, speaking of trailers I did not see the trailer to Hereditary.
I know.
Nope.
And did you go and watch it after you saw the movie?
I haven't yet, actually. And somebody told me I should because it's not a big spoiler thing. But what I will say with that one, usually it's because I don't want to see like key scenes. In this case, I just didn't even want to know what the tone was.
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised because the tone was somewhat different. In my head, I guess that this might be one that's going to be a little harder. Like, we're not going to give away plot points purposely.
Yeah, it's really hard not to, like, yeah, we just have to talk about it very vaguely.
I would suggest if you haven't, if you really want to avoid Hereditary spoilers, just skip 5 minutes, you know, of this right now, just because we are going to all discuss having seen it. But in my head, and I can say this because this isn't the story, in my head, what that movie was going to be was a... Because everyone's talking about how great Toni Collette is. In my mind, it meant, oh, she's going to be like possessed from frame one.
Yep.
And it's a possession movie like Last Exorcism of Emily Rose. That's literally the movie I had in my head. And then when I watched it, I fell so hard in love with Toni Collette as an actress because she's so funny. That she brings this humor and pathos to a character that otherwise this entire movie sinks into a place where I couldn't even watch it because of the depths of dark material without her. But she brings this thing where you're laughing at the terrible decision she makes. She's half laughing, half, you know, it's one of the best performances I've seen
in a genre film ever.
She is the movie.
A big part of that is what she's able to do to keep you. I think she's the thing. There's so many other great things stylistically about it, but she's the thing that keeps you able to watch this movie. And that's great because that's what acting's, you know.
I loved Gabriel Byrne, who I do have to say, afterwards, we had a very, I saw this in my hometown. It was really cool to be, I was back visiting my parents in Winchester, Virginia, and we have an Alamo Draft House there.
Oh, cool.
And they don't play a lot of tiny films like this still. But there's this wonderful, wonderful group called Psycho Cinema that always makes sure that even if 50 people show up, that they're going to show something like this. And it might be at midnight on a Tuesday, but they're going to make sure that they still show it. So I got to see this with the Psycho Cinema group, which was just awesome. And afterwards, I ended up in a debate with some of them about if Gabriel Byrne was the best husband ever or the worst husband ever.
Well, we'll have to – spoilery, we can't go too
much. I know,
we can't. Not that that's a big factor, but – I think I was a big fan of the show Entreatment, and that's the one thing, because he's played the devil so many times. He's played like evil people many times.
Yeah.
He's easy to play that kind of, but in Treatment, I think my guess would be he got cast from that because in that he's a therapist and it's an amazing show where he just listens to different people and he's a good listener. And I think in this movie, he was an excellent listener and he's this guy really trying to hold his,
I thought he was a good husband trying.
Yeah.
Or at least trying to be a good husband. That was my take from it. Because I also liked the whole, it could have gone, I mean, it didn't, and this isn't a spoiler either, but it could have gone, you know, they obviously hint very much that Toni Collette's character has a history of mental illness. Mm-hmm. Or it could be construed as that.
She has a family history. Yeah.
A family history, but her in particular, there were a lot of things they hinted at with her.
Yeah, like having, she'd been to a doctor before.
Yeah, and things that she might have done in the past that involved her family that might be
One of the scariest and funniest parts of the movie.
Yeah.
Where just people talking about something that happened in the past. It's not even action you're watching. It's just them telling
you. And so, so there is that element where you could think, is this all her?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's, you know, so I thought that was kind of interesting too. For me,
Tell me about the audience too, where you start, because we all start in different places and I'm hearing, somebody, Leonard Maltin's daughter, who I listen to their podcast sometimes, she wrote today, like, what are people talking about? Everyone in our crowd just laughed. It was one of the worst experiences. So boring, bad movie. And I was like, wow. In the theater I was in, all horror directors, pretty much everyone. It was Mike Mendez's birthday. Everyone there was in horror. You could have heard a fucking pin drop.
Yeah.
And people were glued to the screen. Like, I haven't had that experience for months.
Yeah, I had a good crowd. I went to the NoHo 7 a few nights ago, and it was mostly, it was just a general audience, and most of them were like teens or early 20s, and I was nervous that they were going to pull their phones out and do without. Much to my shock, they were really into it.
Cool.
There were bits that they laughed. Because it's there. The movie's so dark and dense.
Yeah.
The part that Elric was just talking about where Toni Collette is doing like the monologue about her history, there was laughter. And I laughed myself too.
Because she's funny. She's a comedy actress.
She's funny in that
scene. She comes from comedy. I mean,
yeah.
Well, I didn't find that funny, that monologue.
It all depends on who's listening, I think.
Definitely chuckling a bit.
It's one where you're just like kind of listening like, holy shit. Yeah, yeah.
But that's why. It gets so off the rails to where you're just like, this is nuts.
McGarris's red humor. Remember that? How he always talks about it?
Yeah.
It has moments of that for real.
I think this movie is, it's great. It's really great. I don't love it. I'm not like over the moon about it. But I think considering what's been out there in the genre, I think this film is great. And the main reason is because it's not really, don't expect like a jump scare fest. It's emotionally devastating. Mm-hmm. Like, that's to me, like, I just couldn't get over the dread of how horrible things are and like in what happens to this family. And it's just so emotionally devastating. It reminded me of like Don't Look Now with a touch of like Rosemary's Baby, maybe like that kind of
I was making
vibe.
A list of movies. I think I posted four of them, those four. But then other people would write to me and I'd be like, yeah, you're right. The Sentinel's a big one.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Rosemary's, Don't Look Now. And then art films like Ice Storm and like movies you know he loves.
So
like
that, since I saw this at an Alamo, before the movie starts, they play interviews with the directors where they ask the directors.
I hate that they do
I know. They play these like,
I'm
sitting there like ordering my popcorn and my fried pickles, which is the greatest part of seeing a movie at the Alamo is the fried pickles. But I'm ordering my food. And in the meantime, it's like this giant interview where the director goes through a list of movies that he asked the cast to watch. And Don't Look Now was obviously one of the biggest one. He said The Shining 2, which he talked about how he considered it to be part comedy. Which makes sense having seen it.
He talks a lot about that on Mixed Show.
Yeah,
which I finally
really
listened to after I saw the movie. Even though it is not spoiler at all.
Yeah, I kind of like a follow-up spoiler version of that afterwards to really dive into the movie. And I want to correct one thing because I the journalism, I hate it. So many parts of this. So many articles were posting saying Ari Aster says this is not a horror film. And it's that whole thing like the free camp thing. No. It's a bullshit headline because then I'm driving in the car and there's an interview with him where he's talking to somebody on like KCRW and he said, It's 120% a horror film. He said, when I went around to studios pitching it, I pitched it not as a horror film.
Yes.
And that's what the statement is. But people are saying now he's saying it's not a horror film. No, he says it's a horror film that I had to lie to get made.
Yeah.
So he's only reinforcing the problem. You know, he's telling us, yes, it's a problem, but it's not his problem.
You don't get Tony Collette and Gabriel Byrne if you're like doing a horror movie. Yeah.
Well,
you know?
The films that he made the cast watch and the ones that he said were his biggest inspirations for it were all horror films.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily even think he's likely to be the kind of guy who will make more horror films. I think this could be a one and done scenario, and he'll make interesting fucked up movies.
Yeah,
but that said, you were talking about it is devastating, but then also it is one of my favorite genres where you get a last act of bonkers horror beats.
Oh god!
Oh my god.
It's also delivers, and I think where we have this debate about saying like It Comes at Night is it's all set up and then nothing delivered.
Nothing.
This movie has lots of setup, but then delivers and then some, maybe too much so, in a way that's super entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
And so I really
a lot of people are not paying attention because I picked up a lot of stuff just from the beginning, like that was like hinting at things to come. I just didn't know what they meant at the moment.
Yeah, me too.
But I love the way that things kind of connected and. There's talking about the theatrical experience. There's one fairly shocking incident, maybe 30 minutes into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go a little more than fairly shocking. I'd say it's probably one of the most shocking things I've seen in the movie theater.
I was in Scream.
What was amazing about that scene is literally everybody in my audience, like including myself, held their hands against their mouth.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
For like 5 minutes straight.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's something that's hard to do. And I've been saying to people because of the crowd I saw it in, this is like the horror film that could actually unnerve people who aren't unnerved by horror films anymore.
Yes.
And that's a rare thing. And it might not translate as well to a general public who want bump and scare, you know?
Yeah.
A Quiet Place might be better for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, this is the kind of horror movie that gets me excited about the genre. You know, I need to see it again. Like, no matter what, I think it's an instant classic. Like, I think instantly this will be a film 20 years from now and make top lists of horror. In terms of loving a movie, that feeling where you love it and champion it, like Black Coat's Daughter, it had less, like, I have a little bit less in with it because of his detached style.
It's so heavy, too.
Yeah, it's heavy, but he also is kind of Kubrickian, and he does detach from it, so it's a little harder for me to go like, oh, that's my favorite. It's more like, I just know that that's a fucking classic. Mm-hmm. Same with The Witch.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have yet that personal thing for me, but I'm excited. I think it amazes me that, I get that some people wouldn't like it, but to say it's a bad movie is very strange to me, because this is like, for first film is so confident.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, here is the movie I want to make, you know? Eat it.
And it's batshit crazy. The idea that he was able to sell this, I mean, that's a whole podcast in itself. Like, how on earth would you sell
Hopefully
this?
Hopefully we can get him on. I mean, it'd be nice, like, if after this has been in theaters for a while, to try to get him on so we could actually talk spoilerly and, you know, really go into the movie and the design of it. Because the design's amazing. And the thing with miniatures is amazing.
Yeah.
There's just so much to it. It's one of the only horror films I've seen lately that I'm really in a hurry to go back and see to see what else was there.
And I definitely had, it was really interesting for me to watch watch for one particular scene, which Turek had been nice enough to warn me about in advance. There's a scene.
I worried about you the whole first 30 minutes.
I thought about nothing else but Becca.
I was like,
It's not a spoiler. Within, I'd say, the first 20 minutes of the movie, one of the characters has a really severe allergic reaction to nuts.
Which
I've had many of. And so it was weird watching that. And Turek had warned me about it in advance because he was like, I don't want you to like have an anxiety attack while watching this or anything, or flashbacks, which of course I did because I'm sitting there eating my fried pickles and popcorn going, oh my God, could I be reacting right now? Which is what you do when you have severe food allergies. And but that in itself was really just an interesting scene to watch, because when I was talking to people afterwards, I thought that I was only feeling like amped up because I suffer from it and I've been through that. But apparently, you know, that same build, the idea of
everyone was
your throat slowly closing and being completely helpless, like it was that way for everybody. So,
And the best horror, like all my favorite horror films find the horror in the everyday thing. Like I always think of the Hellraiser thing when they're moving the bed and he cuts himself on the neck. Yeah. That's the scariest part. And so it's the thing that we've all done or could have done that gets you in it, and then the fantasy can come, you know, afterwards.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a great, great movie. Everyone, every horror fan needs to see it in a theater, but you don't need to like it. Like, you might hate this movie. That's totally fine. But I really do think you should see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because we don't make movies like this very often. They don't come along.
And it's definitely a treat that we would get something like this. Again, I'm like, I don't know how the hell this guy sold
with
this
stars,
movie.
Too.
Like with stars. You know, yeah, because it's kind of, it gets batshit crazy at the end. And you're like, how did he sell this to people? And so, don't make sure this one does well, because this is how we get nice things.
So Hereditary so far is Shockwaves approved.
Yeah. Yes. And I actually think we already know Ryan likes it. I just don't know how much. I've never heard. He started at a festival way back.
Yeah, wow.
And I know he liked it, but I don't know if he loved it.
Yeah,
because
I even directly asked him, like, what is it about? And he goes, just know it's got like the allergic reaction, but I'm not going to tell you anymore because I don't want to ruin it. So he was like really strict on me.
Yeah, for anyone who thinks we just ruined the movie, I wouldn't worry. There's a lot more than allergic reaction.
We didn't touch on anything.
There's a lot more going on in that movie.
Yeah. All right. Well, Hereditary. I'll kick us off because this is a film that Becca talked about a way long time ago in the show, and I don't know why I put it off so much. I think I was put off because I had heard it was a TV movie. It's actually a Showtime movie.
Or because Becca told you to see it.
Because Becca told us to see it.
No, but this is When a Stranger Calls Back.
I know. Part two is
haven't seen it.
Fucking amazing.
All right, Elric.
A sequel?
I'm not even kidding you. All right, okay.
Oh my God.
Wait, Rob, there's a sequel.
Becca, hold.
Fuck.
Do you mind? We're trying to talk to you about this movie.
Holy fucking shit. I'm going to.
Rob, give me some mansplain.
Oh, good Lord.
Give me the best mansplain you got. Give me all of it.
No, and actually, I got to give it to you because it was, Becca, the same person did this to both of us.
Dave Parker.
Uh-huh. Got to give credit to Dave Parker. Now, here's the thing. When a Stranger Calls, the original with Carol Kane, is an okay movie. But what it really builds upon is a killer opening and a killer closing that's really the best part of Black Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the best part of Black Christmas. Like, oh, let's make a whole movie around it. And yet, the whole movie's not about that. It's just the beginning and the end. And then there's a whole hour in the middle that's just about this creepy guy that gets out of an insane asylum. You're like, what the hell is this movie?
Yeah.
So it's not a movie that you think right away, like, oh yeah, I can't wait to see the next one. Oh wait, the same guy wrote and directed it. Oh yeah, I can't wait to put that on. But what happened was I was having a movie night. I think it was Josh Miller and Dave Parker were over, and we watched Code of Silence with Chuck Norris, which is a good Friday night movie. It was just whatever, kind of mindless. But it ended
up. Is that the one where he jumps off the train into the Chicago River?
Yes, for sure.
Director of The Fugitive.
Yep, that is true.
Andrew
all
Davis.
True, all true. And so anyway, we ended kind of early, and it was like, oh, you know, what else to watch? And we were skimming through my Amazon queue, my Amazon Prime, and When a Stranger Calls Back was on my Prime list. It's been there since probably Becca mentioned it. So I was like, oh.
Like 6 years ago.
Yes, along with 200 other titles that I'll never get to. Yeah. but anyway, we were skimming past it, and Parker just said, he's like, have you ever seen this? And I'm like, no. He's like, just watch the first 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, why? He's like, I'm telling you, this first 10 minutes is one of the greatest openings to a horror movie ever. And keep in mind, this is 3 years before Scream. And I'm like, oh, okay. And we put it on, and he's fucking right. The opening is so rock solid, and it's basically, I don't want to give anything away, just watch it on Amazon Prime immediately, but it's, what's her name? Jill Sholin is a babysitter who gets left with a kid upstairs in the same manner as the original movie. And basically, she's completely alone, and somebody knocks on the door who's just like, hey, my car broke down, can I use your phone? And when she goes to pick up the phone is dead. And so now it becomes kind of like Yeah, I called them. It's going to be a while. And he's like, oh, okay. Are you sure? Do you need my card number or whatever? It almost becomes kind of like a mind game, if you will. Mm-hmm. But you don't know. It's like, is that guy in, like, is it coincidence or what's going on here? But it is exceptional. It's like right from the first few minutes, you're like, holy shit, this movie's amazing. And even better is the whole movie's great.
Yep.
It's not like the first movie. Where it goes after that opening sequence, the way they bring Carol Kane back in, and basically they're trying to figure out who this guy is, quote unquote guy, Charles Durning, she brings him in because he's kind of like a badass that's like investigating the whole thing. And where it goes is so unexpected and so interesting. And just, I mean, it's the same writer director, Fred Walton. And it was almost like he'd been thinking about for years, like, man, I could have probably done that much better. And this is that movie. I mean, nailed it. And even the last.
Sounds like a Becca movie. Maybe she'd like it.
Yeah, I think. You should totally see this, Becca. Totally like me, guys. Yeah, so I was completely floored by this because it was the same thing where Parker was like, have you seen this? You have to see this. And I definitely took some convincing because I was like, really? The first one's like, okay, it's got like that great line, but not much else. And then he was like, just watch the first 10 minutes and you'll be hooked. And I was, oh my gosh, it's so good.
Yeah, and I got a lot of people on the group because I was like, guys, this is on Prime right now and you have to watch it. So I'm telling you, absolute immediate watch. It's knowing your tastes, especially after listening to your cult episodes of Pure Cinema, you're going to freaking love this movie.
It's weird that I've never even like really heard of it.
Well, you know what's interesting? I looked into it because I'd heard it was a TV movie initially. But when I watched it, there's like nudity and violence. I'm like, it's not TV.
It doesn't feel like a TV movie.
Somebody told me today that it's a Showtime original, which makes sense because in the early 90s, they did Psycho 4 the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of the early day of when HBO and Showtime were kind of getting these known properties and making sequels to them. So that makes sense to me that this was a sequel in the same way that Psycho 4 was from that time period for Showtime. But yeah, When a Stranger Calls Back on Amazon Prime now, must watch.
Yes.
I would throw to Becca, but I have to jump because you just said Jill Schoen.
Oh,
I
have a
Jill Schoen connection. I am a huge fan of Stepfather. I think it's one of the best movies.
Love it.
Period. Mm-hmm. But I did not recall, I did see them when I was young, Stepfather 2 and Stepfather 3 are both on Amazon Prime right now.
You can stop it too.
hey, wait till you hear this. You could be right. Stepfather 2, it was interesting. Like, it's still pretty well made, but it feels way more like a Lifetime movie influence. Mm-hmm. Like, you feel the difference. One of the big differences in this one, because Terry Quinn still comes back.
Right.
But one of the problems, the first one, the thing that's so cool is that Jill Schoen is like a daughter in peril because he's kind of invading the family unit. It's less about his relationship with his like new wife than it is about the girl. In this one, it's only about the relationship with his new wife, which is Meg Foster. Or they're engaged. Meg Foster, who is, you know, creepy eyes from so many movies. So she's also already a weird love interest for me. She's like a real estate agent.
I have so much to tell you after you're
from this. Caroline Williams is the is one of the kind of new patients he's taking. So she's really good. It also made me question, has she aged? Because she looks exactly the same now. And this movie's like 20 years. They're both really fun. It's fun. The setup's good. How he gets out of prison's ridiculous. You know, pretty absurd. But it's fun to watch because of him. There's something I had to mention. It's one of my favorite. So one of my favorite reveals of all time is when Caroline Williams calls him out and says, hey, like, I wonder if you really are the guy you say you are. And he's like, no, I am. Yeah, it's been a long time. And she goes, well, I went, you know, I looked up your school and you got this piece of mail because she's a male woman. And he goes, oh, yeah, I got a letter from my old high school. Yeah, no problem. And she goes, well, I mean, it turns out, you know, you must have changed a lot since those days because I've got a photo right here. And he's like, well, you know, we all change. I mean, I was so young. And she goes, really? And she just holds up a photo of an all black basketball team. And it's one of the silliest gags, but I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
Jeff Burr directed. Who's
Jeff Burr. That's what I'm going to tell you. The buddy, wonderful Jeff Burr.
Leatherface and many other. He's a good director. And so it's like solid workman movie. I had one fun thought. I know you hadn't seen it because it wasn't in our top 100, but it made me realize that the first Stepfather movie is actually Night of the Hunter.
Oh, wow.
When you think about what that means to have a stepfather who joins the family and then terrorizes kids, I was like, I'd never thought of that before.
Which is a title that Kane and I both wanted on the 100 list.
We'll discuss it. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll.
We fumbled the ball on Stepfather not being in the top 100.
There's quite a couple. Maniac. Like, there was a few that people would mention. I was like, how did we? But well, I think, you know.
Quick story about Stepfather, too, though. So Jeff Burr did direct it. He's great. I did a really lengthy interview with him on Icons of Fright like 10 years ago. And he's so candid about about everything. And so one of the two great stories from this is, one is he did not want Meg Foster because he said, like, nothing against her, yeah, but he said this goes against everything that is the stepfather wanting a normal, regular, yeah, he's like, you got a girl with these like crazy eyes. Yeah. It's like, he wouldn't do that. That's not what the unit he would go for. And in fact, the actress he really wanted that they denied him ended up being the lead of Part 3. That's
crazy.
Who he was asking for. I forget her name. Bizarre. Susan Hubley, maybe?
Maybe.
I can't picture Meg Foster as a male woman.
No, not the male woman. The male woman was Carolyn Williams.
Yeah, Carolyn
Williams.
Oh, okay.
No, but Meg Foster's a real estate agent, and she's just kind of...
As the new wife he's marrying into, because the whole point of his character is that he wants the
normal,
perfect...
Normal, typical American, yeah, family.
And so that's number one. And number two, if you think some of the gore gags and things are out of place, yeah, that's because none of it was him. He made a more straightforward thriller like the first one.
Yeah.
And guess who bought this movie? The Weinstein brothers. And his one interaction with the Weinsteins is they did a screening of it, which went really well. Uh-huh. And this is a quote from the interview. He came out and he said they were pacing back and forth like a bunch of bullies on a schoolyard.
Yeah.
And they started screaming at him like, where's the fucking blood? What the fuck, man? Where's the blood? Uh-huh. We need to know. You got to add blood to this. And he was like, well, I'm not doing it. And Terry Quinn's not coming back for reshoots. Like, this is the movie we made. And so that's all another director added in, wow, all the violence.
Especially
stuff.
Towards the end. I mean, there's a bonkers, like, wedding. They're about to get married and there's blood everywhere. It just, like, Terry Quinn is so good. He's like what we're talking about, Tony Collette in Hereditary. He's that good, yeah, stepfather. In this, he's just that character and he's fine. You like, he doesn't do anything wrong, but there isn't much scope for him to shine. It's an okay movie. But just quickly, so I thought to myself, all right, I'll watch 3. Because I remember watching, ooh, 3. I watched the first 15, no, about 12 minutes, and I don't really turn off movies much. The main thing I wanted to see is, how do they get him back in the world, and what do you do without Terry Quinn? How do you handle not having Terry Quinn? And the answer is, you don't, and you drop the ball and make a total mess of a movie. Like, it opens noirish, and he's getting facial surgery, very noir. I can live with all that. But as soon as I see the actor who is now playing him, it's like, not only did they change his face, but they made him probably 15 years younger, goofy, like, just not, no charisma at all. And as soon as I saw that, oh, he's the guy I'm going to watch this movie, and it's like, nope, done. Push stop. We'll never push play on that, no matter what you tell me. It just kind of lost any interest. So anyway, but do check out 2. I think, especially if you love 1, 2 is definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
Just not perfect.
Becca?
Well, I'll start with 2 quick things. So I had mentioned a couple shows ago that I was watching Picnic at Hanging Rock, the new TV show on Amazon Prime. Finished it, loved it, quite possibly my favorite kind of televised, ooh, experience of the year so far. So highly recommend.
Without giving me any spoilers, does it go somewhere different?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And it's not horror, but it's Ryan Murphy. So I will say, Pose on effects, I'm fucking loving. But it's not horror. So check it out.
So should we just talk about Glee while you're at it?
I know.
That's
Glee,
not horror.
Glee.
That's Ryan Murphy.
That's Ryan Murphy. No, I'm just saying. Pose is awesome. Anyway, but the film I will start by talking about took some convincing for me to watch. So on a lot of the panels that I was on at Phoenix Comic Con, including bold horror statements, which we may or may not be doing as an episode soon.
That was the least bold thing you've ever said.
Right?
You just said bold horror, and then you said, which we may or may not do.
We may or may not. So I'm going to go wishy-washy
not at all
there.
Bold.
And I was also on one, like, the scariest movie I've ever seen and things like this. And at the end of them, you always open it up to audience questions. And on at least 3 of the panels, I received questions about whether or not I'd seen this movie called Hell House LLC.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned this recently.
And I tweeted about it and was like, I have no idea what this is, but 3 times over the course of the 4-day stretch, people asked me if I had seen Hell House LLC. And some of them were coming from people that I really respect their opinion, like horror fans and Shockwaves listeners that I've known for a long time, that I was like, okay, if they're telling me to watch this, I will. It's found footage. Hmm. And I usually will not watch found footage films just because I tend to get a little motion sick. But that many people recommending this to me, I had to watch it. It's on Amazon Prime right now. The movie was made in 2016, and it's just now starting to gain a lot of notoriety since it hit Amazon Prime. It's great. And I don't like found footage films, and I still thought it was great. The setup is that this group of young adults, they're probably like 20 to 30s, decide to buy a haunted, well, they don't even know it's haunted. They decide to buy a rundown house in the middle of kind of a small town to turn into a haunted house for the Halloween season. Mm. And so you know from the start that some type of terrible tragedy happens on the night that they open it and 15 people die. Mm. And then it goes to interview footage with one of the survivors, who then reveals that she has tapes, cell phone videos, and everything that they documented of them putting the house together. Like from the day that they buy it to the night that they open it and the 15 people die in this kind of obscured tragedy. And then it just literally goes through the footage of things going on. And it's slow and it sets up a lot of stuff. And it made me realize what makes good found footage is the same thing that made Hereditary good. Mm. It's laying down pipe and groundwork and dropping breadcrumbs that you are later going to use. And that's what I think has turned me off about a lot of found footage film is it's just like, we're going to go into the woods and chase this monster. And then, oh my God, the monster shows up and it feels kind of weak. And I've seen a lot
of found
footage
films. Because it became a crux. It was easier to go, oh, the only way to make a movie is to make it found footage. And that's so the wrong impetus was made, you know?
And so this, within them kind of creating the house and developing it, you start getting kind of these setups of like, okay, well, this is going to be here and this doesn't actually work and we need to fix the motor to this machine. And then when things happen, and they lay all this pipe work about the different characters and how they're interacting with each other and kind of what their goal is. Like it feels like a fully developed movie that just happens to be shot found footage. And because of that, when the scares happen, they happen with impact. And I watched this in the house by myself, and it works. It's really effective. It's got some really good scares in it. I'm not sure I would recommend it to people who don't like found footage. I'm not sure that it's going to turn everybody, because it definitely does have some like running through the house and I don't know what I'm running from moments to it. Mm-hmm. But that said, it's got some really good scares and it was just a really clever setup for found footage. It was like how I want found footage to be done. It made me reappreciate elements of found footage.
I'm going to watch it 6 years from now. Yeah. Just like when Stranger Calls
like,
again.
Hey guys.
And I'll be like, Becca, there's
episode 201.
Back when found footage is cool again, 6 years from now.
And after I tweeted about how much I loved it, the director, Stephen Cognetti, reached out to me on Twitter and he listens to Shockwaves.
Oh,
so,
hello.
Stephen, thank you so much
I'm
for gonna making a good
it
movie.
I'm going to watch it tomorrow,
right?
Man, I'm excited.
Not 6 years from now or anything.
Why would I wait?
They actually shot it in a real haunted house in Pennsylvania, which I thought was really smart.
I love that you just bold horror statements. You just called something a real haunted house, which means it's actually haunted.
A real haunted house is in like every October. Okay, it opens as a haunted attraction.
Less bold.
I'll call it.
We'll
less bold. On. Less bold.
All right.
I don't believe in ghosts. You know
Hell,
that.
Hell House LLC on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
I picked up a little movie on Blu-ray that has no right to be on Blu-ray, but it is.
Every movie has the right.
Called Death Ship.
Oh, yeah.
Starring that's George Death Kennedy and Richard Crenna.
Richard Crenna playing the same character as Rambo, first quote. No. I wish.
No, not even. So this is from Scorpion Releasing, which is kind of Code Red adjacent, but really you can buy this on RoninFlix.com. That's kind of where they just did the house on Sorority Row, which I picked up, which was terrific. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a flawless 2K scan of this ridiculous movie. I remember because my Icons of Fright co-creator, Mike Cucinata, was a huge fan of this. Like, George Kennedy is one of his favorite actors of all time. And so he's the one that would always talk about this obscure movie where he kind of becomes possessed by a Nazi on an abandoned ship.
Double feature with Crawl Space with Kinski.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah, that's, that makes sense. Yeah. So this movie is pretty batshit and interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think it's great, but
it's
it is
interesting,
definitely
though. Like,
it's
your interest. Interesting. Well made. Big things happen. Like big
and
boat
I feel
deaths.
Like it must
having
be
some slow burn. Like I remember being bored.
It's pretty slow, but when stuff happens, like it's right on the cover. There's a really great shower sequence that involves the shower raining blood.
Yeah,
I remember the film strip being really terrifying in it. Am I thinking of the right movie?
I don't know about the film strip.
Ghost
or,
ship
no, ghost it's the PA system.
There is a thing with the
PA. Yeah. Like that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I don't remember Ghost Ship, but Ghost Ship has to be a remake of this, right?
No, not at all.
Because they both have an identical beginning. Mm-hmm. But that's it.
Yeah,
and also identical artwork, because that is absolutely the original.
So I actually think you should see Ghost Ship, Rob, because it's actually, I really like that movie.
I don't know why I never have that, because everyone says the opening is amazing
the
and the rest of it
like
sucks.
Fucking bonkers.
First 10 minutes is awesome.
Yeah.
First 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the same director as 13 Ghosts?
It is.
Production keeps coming back to that.
Can you phone a friend? Scott Taylor.
Scott Taylor Compton. Death Ship. So yeah, it's an interesting movie. It's not a great one, but again, I just love that Scorpion is just snatching up these movies and and really giving him the special edition treatment. So, yeah, if you like weird shit with George Kennedy. Now I'm waiting for Demon Warp. Is that the name of the movie? There's another really weird one he did called Demon Warp that I bought a bootleg of at a convention like 20 years
ago. He's also in Just Before Dawn.
Just Before Dawn. Oh. Great one. So whoever does that is a winner in my book. Okay, what else you got?
I got one, you got one. You go first.
I will go to The Vineyard, which I pulled up because I thought you guys would recognize the cover.
Nope.
Even if you don't.
Vaguely.
Okay, so The Vineyard came out in 1989, and this is written, directed, produced, possibly catered by James Hong, who most people know as Lo Pan from Big Trouble in Little
China.
Guy.
Great actor.
Which I have a feeling that somewhere along the lines, he must have pitched this movie to John Carpenter, and I wish I could have been listening in on that conversation. But anyway, so he decided to make it himself, and it is just bonkers, and I cannot call it a good movie, but very much like Death Spa. Yeah. This is a film you need to watch at a party or gather up all of your horror friends and say, okay, we're in for a fucking treat, because it's all over the place. So the setup is that Dr. Elson Poe owns a vineyard, and he's the leading wine celebrity. Because that's a thing. So everyone knows who he is, and they're like clamoring to meet him. And it opens by establishing like how 80s cool he is, that he's really wealthy. And then it cuts to what you think is going to be a soft scene, a sex scene, because it goes to this soft focus. And then his wife gives him a back rub. And that's all it is. And I was
is James Wong Howe playing that character or not?
No. James Wong is playing the character.
Of course he is.
Yeah, he is the high-powered vineyard owner. So you get this 80s sex scene that literally is nothing more than a very unsatisfying back rub. And then right after the back rub, he turns into this like Brundlefly looking character where like he grows protrusions out of his face and he gets kind of zombie-ish. And he runs down to his basement, and it's then revealed that he drinks this combination of distilled human blood and jade stone, and therefore he stays alive forever. And to feed his need for human blood, he has this assortment of scantily clad 80s ladies with really big hair chained up in his basement. And he just kind of drains blood from them whenever he wants to. And
that's so Lo Pan, actually.
I know. And then he has a whole crew of oversized, very silent lackeys that protect his secret. So, and then this is the weirdest thing. It cuts to this bad fight scene, which is kind of kung fu-ish, but not good kung fu. It's like two drunk guys fighting at a wedding. And then it goes back to the movie, and I still don't know how the fight scene clicks in. But again, this is a party movie, nonsensical as shit. And then he decides that he's going to invite seven people to his house for the weekend. I kid you not, because he wants to make a winemaking movie, and he wants these seven people to be actors in his movie. But this is where it gets weird. Amongst the seven people, there's a couple of like hot actresses. Then there are wine critics, and then there's also journalists who want to interview him. And so it feels like he scheduled three different events on the same weekend. But bear with me here, because we're going somewhere.
I don't think this is a movie.
It is. This is a real movie.
Is this a fever dream you have?
Yeah.
I'm tired of
it. So then all seven people show up at his house for the weekend, and he starts cursing them. I don't know why he doesn't just like take them down to his basement and chain them up. Instead, he finds it easier to use these like voodoo doll-ish tactics that I guess he learned from the ancients and make tarantulas appear in their throats. Or in one point, he makes the snake appear in bed with this like scantily clad woman. It gets batshit crazy. Then the zombies show up. Now, there's really no explanation about where the other zombies come from.
Yeah, are you revealing like everything to us?
No, no. And this is like the first half of the movie.
Wait, so when did Fulci make this? What part of the
exactly. So I will end it with, and then the zombies show up. So
all right.
Where did you see this madness
this
called The Vineyard?
This is on Amazon. It cost me $2 to rent.
Shit.
I can best sum it up as I don't know what the fuck was going on, and I was really trying.
Why did you rent it? Why?
Did you stumble onto it?
So the way that I actually stumbled onto this is I was at a used bookshop in Virginia, in Strasburg, Virginia, while I was there. Uh-huh. And it's this amazing shop that I usually, it's mostly used books, but they always have used VHS tapes too, and I always find the most batshit crazy stuff there. And I found a used VHS of The Vineyard. And then I immediately looked it up and was like, oh, I can rent it for $2 on Amazon. I'm not going to buy it on VHS. But then immediately, as soon as I got home that night, I was like, well, now I have to watch it because the cover looked amazing.
Becca's putting small businesses
out of business.
By Amazon.
Well, I mean, the VHS was only $2, too.
Oh, my God.
I think Becca killed Jump Cut. Oh. I'm going to throw out a pretty broad statement. Bold horror statements. Becca killed Jump Cut.
I was really trying to understand this movie. And if I remember remember correctly, trivia did very well for Jump Cut.
Yeah, but
Cut,
you still
so.
Killed it. I don't know.
I was like your best customer, maybe behind Emma.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I don't know what the fuck was going on. I can best describe it as weird soundtrack, great 80s hair, a lot of what the fuckery, but it was a lot of fun. So, The Vineyard, 1989.
And she wonders why it takes us 6 years, to get to a record.
I'll see you in 6 years, Rob. I think we need a pact where we'll do a Becca Fiesta, a Becca Palooza, where we'll watch all Becca movies all night just together.
It's really, if you enjoy Death Spa or like Ninja 3, this is, you need to see The Vineyard.
I do. All right,
what do you got, Elric?
All right, guys. I'm very excited about this.
Okay.
Arrow Video. Thank you. This is the first film I've ever gotten an advance a copy of because I met the Arrow people and I am so crazy about this movie. Talked about it on 90s Cult back in Pure Cinema. It's my favorite Abel Ferrara film.
Ooh.
The Addiction
is
a movie I thought I'd never get to see on Blu-ray. Never thought it'd come out. Yeah, Becca just got it right now. This is basically right in alignment with Larry Fessenden's Habit and George Romero's Martin. It would fit perfectly as kind of a trilogy of sorts. This is Lily Taylor in like just a fantastic role. And I love his films in general, but this was always my favorite, but it was also hard to see a good copy of it because even the DVD's been out of print.
Yeah.
This is probably going to be my release of the year. Like, it is a gorgeous black and white transfer. The movie is, I find it quite funny as well because it's really basically an assault on academia. It's really making fun of philosophers, academics, that whole world. But within that, it's a black and white vampire film. It's definitely a horror film. There's no doubt about it. There's bloodletting. There's good stuff. Christopher Walken comes in for a couple scenes that are just dynamite. He's like off the charts. Interesting in this film. Sciorra is great in it. It's just a really interesting movie. It was one of the, I think he made about seven films with Nick St. John, who's a great writer. They made everything except Bad Lieutenant together, and he really didn't want them to make Bad Lieutenant because he's a devout Catholic. Mm. And so a lot of the things we think of as Abel Ferrara's cinema is actually a lot of that comes from Nick St. John, because Ferrara even talks about in the extras that most of these scripts were just handed to him by Nick St. John. No development, no conversations,
disregard
just
Zoe Lund.
She also was a collaborator of his. But just like, that's really interesting because I think a lot of people go, oh yeah, you work together, you workshop ideas. No, his friend handed him scripts that he had no idea he was working on, and then he directed them. And I'm like, that's interesting. But the real star of this disc, because if you haven't seen the movie, you've got a nice treat coming. The extras on this, I don't always have the time to watch all this stuff, but because I got this copy, I was like, I'm going to watch it all. Oh, man, this is so good. Okay, a couple cool things. There's a Abel Ferrara editing this movie, so it's an old clip off his fucking nut, just out of his mind, because he was a wild guy. There's a really cool interview where basically Abel interviews Walken, Lily Taylor, and the DP. And this is why I get excited about movies, because I don't really care about escapism that much. I will go to Hansel's. I like all those movies, but I don't love them anymore. And what I love is tapping into something that's real. And this, Abel Ferrara basically starts talking to each one of them about addiction and their lives. And it is the most honest thing I've ever seen as an extra feature. Lily Taylor starts talking about her addiction to alcoholism and how she kind of had to get out of it. He just point blank says to Walken, Philip Seymour Hoffman, man. And Walken starts going, I would go out with him all the time for dinner and he wouldn't even have a drink of wine. That's how clean that guy was. He was like, I had no idea what was happening with him under that. It was just absolute tragedy. You see Walken tear up. And then Ferrara's like, I didn't try heroin for 44 years. Even when I made this movie, I still had never tried it. And then one day I tried it, and then I was on it for 14 years, and I must die. And he talks about how it just ravaged him, and now he's clean again. He just had a baby, 66. He just had a baby with a woman in Italy. He lives in Milan. But the conversation they have, it's just so refreshing to see people go. It's not about – they're all talking about where they are in their age and how that buys you a whole different world because you don't give a fuck. It was so refreshing, man. I loved it. It got me excited about these kind of indie films that know what they are. And also, it was made for nothing. They talk about how they had to basically get Teamsters to work for nothing and defer payment. Like, no one got paid on this movie. So it's like his little movie, and he had done some big stuff. So it's really cool. And there's a couple other things in there, but they're all good. All the extras were super – I didn't get to listen to the commentary, obviously, but Abel, you won't get better commentary than Abel, because he's just off his head. It's like, oh, who's that chick? I remember that chick. Oh yeah, she was hot. I like that chick. I mean, it's just his brain is uncensored.
My greatest New York moment, because Abel Ferrara lived next door.
Yeah.
He lived in the building next door to me.
Well, he was in the Chelsea for a long time.
Yes, and I lived in the building directly next door for 8 years called the Carteret. And lived on the sixth floor there. And Abel and I used the same pharmacy. And there was one day that I was picking up a prescription and there was this gentleman in front of me arguing with the pharmacist. And I was like, holy shit, it's Abel Ferreira. And he's arguing about why his insurance will not cover his medication. Yeah, and it was the greatest conversation ever.
As an argumentative
ever.
Dude. But there's a part where the scholar at the end just asks him about the ending because there's slight ambiguity to it. Like I would have, I would say there is because it's quite different from the rest of the film. And Abel just looks and goes, no, man, that's as clear as fuck. We fucking nailed that ending. That ending is so clear. What are you talking about? There's no, it means X, Y, Z. What's wrong with you? You can't get that. It's just, it's great. It's like, all right, critics don't get it. But man, it's really a great film and it's just gorgeous. Like the black and white photography in this thing, you just realize you don't get to make movies like that.
It's cool. Anyway. I didn't know this came out.
I think it's like 2 weeks from now. Yeah. It's real soon. So I want to get people excited about it.
Cool.
Nice.
Anything else?
I'm good.
All right. Becca,
couple
you got
quick
plugs.
Things to plug. I do. So the Etheria Film Fest will be the day after when this drops, and the three of us will be there. We'll be announcing who the winner of the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship is, and it's being presented by the Shockwaves team, minus Ryan. So the three of us will be there. So definitely come check it out. Etheria.
Terminal Island is not a woman in prison film.
It is not.
So I will be leading with that next time I meet Stephanie Rothman.
And so that is at the Egyptian Theater on Saturday evening. And just some really amazing shorts from amazing women directors. And then I'm also going to go ahead and mention, because we can announce it now, that the Shockwaves team will be at the Midsummer Scream Con in Long Beach coming up the last weekend of July. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that, but we will be doing a live show at that convention.
And you might see Slashback Video again there.
And Ooh. We're also doing a Dead Right Horror Trivia event as well. So you just get all of the cool parties.
Where and do we then, find the time?
I know.
That's what I
know.
I don't know.
And then I'll also go ahead and plug because I absolutely love these people and what they're doing with it. So on the evening of Saturday, June 23rd at 7:30 at Blast from the Past in Burbank, they are doing, this is Clark Wolf and Chelsea Stardust, two of my two favorite people in the world, are doing a live reading, script reading of Rosemary's Baby. And they're doing it with a complete and total, like, star-studded cast, the people that they've got doing the reading. And all of the money that they're raising, they're recommending $10 donation per person. But all the money that they're raising is going to Planned Parenthood. I will be working the door, so you guys can come. And
Planned Parenthood for Rosemary's Baby, I like that.
Yeah. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, it's a good charity to be given to. So, yeah. So that is on June 23rd in Burbank.
Beautiful. We're going to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Christian James Hand.
Hail, Satan! Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, now available on demand and through Shudder. Jenna's enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her assailants, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent, revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film. Now available through Shudder and most on-demand streaming platforms. I like it a lot.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. They just released a brand new line of Chucky trading cards. The first collection of Cabin in the Woods shirts and pins are now available, and the collection has three awesome Cabin in the Woods shirts as well as five enamel pins, which are the various monsters from the film. And on July 4th, Fright Rags will be releasing a whole new Jaws collection. And if you look back at the Shockwaves team picks from Texas Frightmare, you will see the entire crew wearing Fright Rags shirts. We love them. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Go to www.fright-rags.com now.
The Shockwaves crew is super excited that we are heading to Mad Monster Party in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th to 15th at the Weekapaw Resort just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team will be there doing a live show. Check it out at madmonster.com. Head there for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. While there, be sure to touch Elric's face. Just touch it.
Mitch Pileggi, the Shocker, will be there. So the actual Shocker will be there with Shockwaves. How cool is that? I'm so excited about that.
Mad Monster Party, July.
I guarantee he'll be on our show. No, that's a pretty good idea.
It is.
All right, welcome back to the show. And I am beyond thrilled and excited because sitting here with us is the man, the myth, the legend, my friend Christian James Han. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me in.
Well, thank you. And you know, it's been a while, a long time coming, because you had when back on my birthday last year, we had talked about getting you on Shockwaves in some capacity. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, obviously we're a horror show. It's got to make sense. What you do is spectacular, but not always horror tinged.
Nope.
And then I saw you post, I know you've said this before, but I think it was on our mutual friend Scott Reynolds, one of his posts about music. You started going on a thing about Tubular Bells, the classic piece of music, which everybody listening to this show knows as the theme to The Exorcist. And I was like, this is it. We got to get you in to talk about
the end.
Because nobody knows more. Well, really, I went back to the Exorcist soundtracks before you came in. And even though they credit Tubular Bells on it, they literally only play like the first 45 seconds.
Yeah, it's less than 2 minutes of the actual song appears in the whole movie.
And how long is the actual song?
Well, it's the first side, which that one is taken from, is 25 minutes long.
Yes, it's by Mike Oldfield.
The 2 minute bit at the beginning is the bit that he took, and the director had originally. It's a cool story. He'd actually originally had I found out who had written the.
Lilo Schifrin was the original choice.
And he hated it.
Yep.
He did all the music, and they hated it. And then he later said that he would have used Tangerine Dream if he'd heard that first.
That's right, because he heard it after for Sorcerer. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had, but there was conjecture that he'd heard it on the Georgetown University radio station, which is bullshit. It was actually that he just picked up a bunch of white labels from Ahmet Erdogan's office, and it just so happened that Tubular Bells was one of those, and then he decided upon it upon the instant that he first heard it.
Wow.
Because it's that sort of piece of music.
It does. Like, the second you hear it come in, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's, and it's like one of the creepiest pieces of music written.
Right.
It's almost like you would have imagined that it would have been written for that movie if you hadn't been told that it wasn't.
Who was Mike Oldfield then? Because, like, I only know that name because of that album. So, like, Mike. Who was he as a guy? What was...
Do you know all right. So, the actual... If you want to get into it, we could start... The whole tale of this album itself is epic. I mean,
yes.
It's not to be fucked with. To me, it is the single greatest recording accomplishment in music as an entirety.
Oh, damn.
That's not said lightly.
That's a bold horror statement.
Yeah. No, it's a huge bold horror statement. So first off, you should realize that the entire, so the record is two sides. The first side is side part one, which is 25 minutes long, and the second side is 23 minutes and 20 seconds long. It's all written and performed by one guy, and he was 19 years old at the time that he did it. It's 2,600 overdubs and tape loops to construct this thing.
My God.
And no, it's a fucking mammoth accomplishment that he got this thing done. So when he first did it, he did it in the comfort of his own bedroom as a kid. Like, he's between like about 17 and 19. And he modified a Bang & Olufsen tape deck to be able to multi-track on it. That's the kind of dude that we're talking about here. So he modifies the tape deck in his house to be able to record. And he starts this whole thing. And he recorded it, and nobody gave a shit. So he took it around to a bunch of places, and nobody cared. So at that time, he was also working as an engineer and playing on other people's shit. So he ends up at a studio that's being built by a guy by the name of Richard Branson.
Yeah.
Small name.
Tiny guy. Yeah.
Who at that point really hadn't accomplished himself or hadn't accomplished anything other than being a little bit of a raconteur, and he'd done some cool stuff with a newspaper that he'd started, but he didn't have a record label yet, and he hadn't really done anything in the music space. So he built this studio at his house to just see if he could, and when we say studio, it's like a world-class facility in the back of his yard, because he wanted to kind of get into the music industry and see if he could, you know, and the best way to do that was, instead of hiring out studios, build your own and then just see what you can get out of your own people. So it just so happened that Mike Oldfield, 19-year-old Mike Oldfield, was working at the studio on somebody else's pieces, and then he he was the Tubular Bells, the original, was so far out that not even Pink Floyd's label wanted to touch it.
They were like, we can work with Sid.
I mean, there's weird shit, but then there's really weird shit, Mikey, and this is really weird shit. So he was at the Manor and he was working, and he was talking to one of the engineers, and I couldn't find his name. So he was talking to one of the engineers, and a roadie overheard him talking about this piece of music that he'd written that he had on tape that was, you know, he'd done on four tracks in his bedroom. And the roadie was like, let's hear it. This sounds fucking amazing. So the roadie offers to get in the car, and he drives from the Manor an hour and a half to Mike Oldfield's house, and they pick up the tape and they bring it back. And they listened to it and lost their minds. And then they gave it to one of the dudes who worked at the Manor, and he immediately didn't do anything with it, just sat on it until Mike Oldfield reminded him and was like, hey, have you listened to my thing that I did? And then he listened to it for 5 hours in a row and came back and was like, okay, we have to finish this because it was still an unfinished piece, and then we have to put it out. So when it came to actually finishing it, they basically re-recorded the entire thing because the recordings that he did in his bedroom obviously weren't, you know, album quality. Mm-hmm. So this is when it gets really nerdy and knob twiddly, but it's fucking insane. So what they had to do was they couldn't do it, because when you listen to the thing, it's made up of all these tape loops and these repeating themes, which starts with the most famous of them, of course, which is the whole beginning of the Exorcist bit, which is this. So first off, the time signature is crazy, because it's not in four. It's not 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. It's like fucking 9:17 or some crazy shit. Now, the thing to realize is that there's already like 18 instruments playing. It's not just, you know what I'm saying? It's not like it's one fucking bell sound that's going. There's no MIDI. Like, nothing can trigger at the same time as something else is triggering. So Mike Oldfield, 19-year-old Mike Oldfield, is playing all of these instruments separately to create... So there's bells, like at least four guitar parts. And it starts, this is what's really crazy about it. It starts on the upbeat and ends on the downbeat. So when it begins, see how it doesn't wrap around in a way that makes any sense to you? So they had to, and it just goes on for 25 minutes of instrumental chaos that's all built around this riff. And basically the thing that happens is none of the instruments stop playing. So when you go later on, you know, you can go to like the 6 minute mark. And you get out of this bit, so it goes from... So at 3 minutes, that thing is still going. And then it changes. This comes in, which is him playing 50 guitars with one pair of hands. And then it changes to this. Which is played in a completely different time signature. So what they had to do was they had to basically click track, because they couldn't do it. They kept starting and starting, and everybody got so fucking crazed because he wrote the libretto in a language that only he could understand. Because he couldn't write it out as music, so he had to write it out as symbols so that he could see. Because if you tried to write this out as music, when you've got, it would just then, you'd end up with a phone book of fucking of notes and quavers and all that kind of shit. So he wrote it in symbols that only he could understand. So then what they had to do is they had to map it all out, and then they started... They put different click tracks for different sections. So the click track has to change because not even, so it's the thing that goes donk, 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 donk that you play over the top of. Even that had to change from piece to piece to piece because over the course of the 20 minutes, it starts to build and change and goes into flux and comes out of it. So the mammoth task of even getting the click track to work is fucking crazy. So then they track this whole thing in a week. So that's 50 minutes of like mind-blowing crazy music in a week. It's 2,600 overdubs, which is such a ridiculous amount. And what they would have to do, like this is pre-computer, right? So just to get this to work, the whole intro. He's not playing it the whole time. He plays one loop and then they cut the tape. And then they tape the tape together, and then they tape the tape together, and then they tape the tape together, and they tape. So they take little pieces of like 8 inches of tape or however long it would take for that to loop out, and you would tape that to another piece of tape perfectly, and then another piece of tape perfectly, and you would have these like, you know, it's like taking a piece of like the same, you know, like making a GIF. You say GIF or GIF, whichever GIF. One you do. It's an ongoing argument online, it appears. Fuck everybody. I'm going to say it's a GIF. It's like trying to make an audio GIF where you would take the image and just hand cut the image out of film. So you do the same thing as tape. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's more like cutting on celluloid too, like movies.
Exactly. Yeah. But you're doing it with the audio that you can't see. You can only hear it. So when you do when you there are guys who are masters of editing where you actually have a razor blade on a tape block that's attached to the actual loops of the tape and you cut it and then you mark it and then you fucking tape it and then you just keep doing that over and over again. So this process alone must have been like gobsmacking to watch these guys do. And please, let's not forget, once again, this is a 19-year-old kid. This is not like a 30-year-old musical genius. This is the first piece of music he's ever written. And we'll get to the sort of sad denouement of Mike Oldfield's career afterwards. So,
did he ever talk about where it came from? Like, was this just like random inspiration?
It was just this. Yeah, it was random inspiration in his bedroom as a young kid. And then, but like the really crazy thing is that he then had to sort of adapt his own tape deck to be able to get it to do what he wanted it to do. Like, it wasn't even like he just got a Tascam 4-track and he actually went in and created the device that would allow him to make this. Huh. So this piece of music is fucking epic. So he goes on and they record this thing in a week. And then there's yeah, this is great. So he finishes it, and he was actually going to leave England and go to Russia to become a state-sponsored musician because you could do that in Russia. So he was ready to leave England entirely and just be like, throw it all in the air and go and become a state-sponsored Russian musician. Imagine how different Mike Oldfield's life would have been had that happened. And instead of that happening, it gets discovered, and then they decide that they're going to finish it. So it's Simon Hayworth is the guy who finally convinces Richard Branson to pay for the recordings at the Manhattan Studios, and they gave him a week's worth of time. And the best way to absorb this record is to really get it and then sit down with it, because it's not one of these things that you can sit down and just fucking do 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. You have to listen to the whole thing start to finish. And you think about this whole thing being recorded in a week is such a huge accomplishment, and then to mix it in a month afterwards, which is really, really crazy. So there's over 30 instruments on the record. All of them are played by Mike Oldfield, except for, I found the ones he didn't play. He didn't play the flute, the drums, and the string bass. Everything else is played by him.
So even in the final recording,
he's the only dude. And then there's a band called the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, which was a very big sort of post-acid flashback band in the UK. And Viv Stanchel is the lead singer of that band, who just happened to be getting his recordings done in the same studio and was getting shit-faced. And then they decided to have him, they convinced him to be, later on in the song, or the first side, he's the one who introduces all the instruments, if you've ever heard it, and he goes, and now the bass guitar. We'll see if we can find it, because I don't know where that bit happens. And he's the one who actually said, I'm telling you, this.
What the heck? This doesn't even sound like the same song.
Yeah, I know.
And you can hear all of the origins of Goblin in this.
Oh, no, totally.
Like,
yeah,
it's all there, right there.
It just, it's got one coming up. I'm telling you right now, I'm glad the medical marijuana is legal. Here we go.
Bass guitar.
All right, so here's this. So this is Viv Stanchel. I don't know why this is clipping your.
That was it. Ernie walked away.
They're having trouble. he basically introduces each of the instruments as they come in. So he says, he's like Glockenspiel, and he was the one who said, and now Tubular Bells, before the record was called Tubular Bells. And originally Mike Oldfield was going to call it Opus One, and then
which makes more sense. Right?
And then Richard Branson wanted to call it Breakfast in Bed, and the cover was going to be a boiled egg with blood pouring out of it.
Okay.
So Richard Branson should clearly not be trusted with anything other than running an empire. So details are not his strong suit. And then so Mike Oldfield heard Viv Stanchel say, and now Tubular Bells, and knew that that was the title for the record.
So that's an instrument, a tubular bell?
Yeah, the tubular bell is like it's basically a long metal tube, and then you hit it with a mallet. And interestingly, the mallet that they hit, they went out and tried hammers, they tried everything they could to get these tubular bells to sound good on the record, and they couldn't do it. So the tubular bells that you hear actually on this record are an overdub that Mike Oldfield had to do later because the engineer was like, this just doesn't work. And it's the only regret in the entire recording that Mike Oldfield has is that it's not the original Tubular Bells. Huh. It's like some janky overdub thing that he wanted to do. When they mixed this record, they did it on a regular mixing desk. It took five people because, you know, now you can automate in Pro Tools and make shit do whatever you want it to, raise volumes, add effects and all that with the computer. And back, you know, a few years ago, there were mixing desks that now do it automatically. But this was made in, you know, 77 or whatever it was. And 79 is when it comes out, I think. Everybody had to be on the mixing desk doing it by hand as it went along. And if you've ever seen that, it's incredible because it looks like a dance because people have to, you have like little pieces of paper that stick up that tell you, you got to move this at 3 minutes and four. And if you think about like 25 minutes of music.
So it's like an orchestra.
It's an orchestra control. People, like the mix itself is a work of art because everyone has to raise and lower. And when you've only got, you know, like think they had 48 tracks that they had a 20 channel desk and a 16 track recorder. So what you'd have is like, the drum track would then suddenly have a bass guitar in it and then something else. So you'd have to remember that and pull it down and move the other thing and crank and pan things left and right. I mean, if you listen to this mix on headphones, it's mind-blowing the thought that human beings had to actually do this dance to get this thing to sound the way it did or does when it comes out of the speakers. And there's a 25th anniversary remaster is the one that I have, which is I think the best of all of them. If you want to, you guys get dorky about your black and white reissues, you know, etc. Same thing happens in the audio field. This 25th anniversary re-release is I think the best of all of them, though the original vinyl is hard to beat, obviously.
When did you discover this track? Did you know it from The Exorcist or did you discover it otherwise?
No, because I was a wee lad. So my dad, I think the way that my dad dealt with having an Asperger's son who he didn't know was Asperger's and couldn't understand why he wouldn't shut up. I think he realized that if he smashed this pair of Sennheiser headphones, these yellow spongy Sennheiser headphones that he had, if you put those on and then just put a needle on a record, I would shut the fuck up immediately and just like, mang. So this is how I met Phil Collins for the first time and a bunch of other stuff. And I remember the Tubular Bells was one of the things that he put on. And, you know, I'm like 8 years old, I think, when I first absorbed this record. And it was like one of those that immediately rearranges your musical DNA because it's so different to anything else that you've ever heard. And it's just been with me the whole time. And I've always been a fan of it. And I've showed it to as many people as I can. And I've introduced as many people as possible to it. And I've bought a million copies. So then when I got to actually dip into the story, like eventually somebody needs to do a documentary on this because it progressively gets weirder and sadder. So Mike Oldfield was done once when they first did it. I found this out. I forgot all sorts of useless information. Mm. Oh, by the way, it's released 10 days after his 20th birthday. And he never had a music lesson in his life. So they.
Wow. So wait, how did he learn how to play all these instruments? Tubular bells.
He's an alien.
Okay. Just walk into a room with tubular bells and be like, "Hold on, guys, I got this."
This dude has like this guy never took a lesson in his life, and he played 27 of the 30 instruments that are on this on this thing. And it being his first recording is also fucking crazy. And so. But what's really weird is that it's kind of become he's like Ahab and this is his Moby Dick because he keeps recording it again and again and again. He's on like his sixth version of this thing because he can't quite get it right. Like every time there's a new technology, he re-records Tubular Bells in an attempt to somehow, you know, get it closer to the sound that's in his head because this still isn't it. Which is like it's the same problem that Tom York from Radiohead has, is that he can't, he's like, you know, the moment that you'll finally be able to understand Radiohead the way Tom York hears it is when he can plug a cable into the back of his head and think the music out, because simply the act of having some sort of interface robs him of a translation of the actual sound that he makes. I think Mike Oldfield's had the same problem.
In film terms, everything you've been saying reminds me of Stanley Kubrick because, A, you've got a guy who, when he wanted to make Barry Lyndon, he had to invent the lenses to shoot Barry Lyndon and had to work with NASA to do it. And then he also was editing his movies up until his death, his old movies. He just never finished.
Oh, really?
He couldn't put them down.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the very similar kind of visionary.
It is. And it's
something's
even
wrong with them.
It's even, yeah, no, exactly. And it's even sadder that it's like this, the first thing. Like it's the first thing he did. And he can't get this thing to sound the way he wants. And then, so Richard Branson They take it to a European music conference, and some guy there tells them that he'd love to put it out if they put vocals on it.
Oh,
which is like, I can't even imagine how fucking dumb you got to be to think that that's even possible. But nonetheless, that's when Richard Branson actually steps in and builds Virgin Records to put this record out.
Oh, crazy.
So Tubular Bells was the start of Virgin Records.
The start of Virgin Records. Wow. Because nobody else would touch it, and everybody knew that it was this, you know, stroke of genius. They knew that it was brilliant. Like, you couldn't hear it. And imagine, like, knowing Mike Oldfield and having this 19-year-old kid at your studio at the end of your yard who builds this thing that you're not even sure you really want to put out. And then when you finally hear it, in its entirety, he's like, I have to put it out. And then nobody wants to touch it, so he builds Virgin Records to put this record out. And then he says that, yeah, we got to do it live. So here's when it, you know, like, if you so think about this, right? So this loop that's happening that goes on for, you know, this is 5 minutes in, still happening. And it goes to here. All these pieces, but just having 5 minutes. So 5 minutes live before computers means that you would have to have one musician just sit there and go blung 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 for 5 minutes playing that on a piano.
Yeah,
and then at 3 minutes, some other random dude comes in and starts playing the guitar loop that's different against that other thing. So you'd have to like push human beings to the point of where they would get into this. And there's actually footage on YouTube. You can find footage of them. I actually did a performance for BBC Two, I think it was, or BBC, which is fucking insane because you sit there and watch this dude play the same riff. Huh. For 5 minutes, while Mike Oldfield is like 20 years old and he's steering the whole thing on the guitar. And the idea of like having to score it out so that musicians could read it, and then trusting the musicians to be able to play it the way you had originally played it with your inflections and with the way that you're, you know, like you had put it together. So they did it at the Royal Albert Hall, and before the show, Mike Oldfield had a complete panic attack. And if you're like, Richard Branson's one of my sort of heroes of music. So I read his autobiography, which is fucking brilliant. The Rebel Billionaire. You should absolutely read that. Did anybody see that TV show that he did?
Where it was on
the Rebel TV show. Yeah. So that it was called The Rebel Billionaire. Basically, it was like The Apprentice, except the first half hour was like bullshit apprentice-y stuff. And that was just to decide who did the stunt. Because the last half hour was you had to break a world record that he had decided.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that.
Wow. Oh, no, it's insane. So one of them was that they fucking did a thing and they whittled it down to like 6-7 people or whatever. And then the record that they broke for that episode was the world's highest afternoon tea, which was that he was at the top of a balloon that was like 6 miles in the air, whatever it was. And the people had to climb out of the outside of the balloon up ladders to meet him at the top of the balloon to sit and have fucking high tea on top of a balloon in the air with Richard Branson.
Oh,
and then the
gosh.
Winner got Necker Island, which is the island that he purchased. And so the dude that won it was the one who did like those big beanbag things that were those huge for a while. They were like these beanbag couches. And when they celebrated the ending, the two of them were suspended underneath helicopters and they Superman flew around the island.
What a maniac.
While Richard Branson's showing you what you've won and then you headed up. It's
that sounds way more fun than becoming president.
Oh my God.
Like,
yeah.
I think he could have done a much better direction.
And and a free island.
Yeah.
And beanbags.
Yeah.
So he's a fucking madman. So when they came to do the live show, he sort of forced Mike Oldfield into doing this live show. And Mike Oldfield has a massive panic attack right before the show. Full, you know, it's a full house, whatever. So Richard Branson gets him in his car, and I think it was either it's a Rolls Royce, I'm pretty sure, or a Bentley, but it's probably Rolls Royce. And they drove around London for hours, and Mike Oldfield just couldn't come down from it. So eventually, the only way that Richard Branson gets Michael Oldfield to go on stage to do this is he gives him the car, and he says, "I will give you this Rolls Royce." And in the book, it's kind of sad. In the book, Richard Branson takes full responsibility for it, and he says he's fairly sure that Mike Oldfield was never the same again. Huh. He's like, the pressure of trying to get that piece of music to, or both of these pieces of music to be translated to an audience live at with this level of detail in his brain just broke something in him that he never came back from. And there's a record after this one that he made where it's a complete... It's you might as well just take a bunch of fucking instruments and throw them down a flight of stairs because it's a complete cacophony. It doesn't work. It's the opposite of Tubular Bells, and he did it on purpose because he wanted to break the heritage of Tubular Bells. Mm-hmm. And then he did the Killing Fields soundtrack, which is incredible.
Yeah, great movie too.
Great movie. Yeah. And then he proceeds to do like four or five other things and then just keeps coming back to Tubular Bells over and over and over and over again. And he now lives in his own island in the Bahamas because the record sold, it sold 2.5 million copies in the UK. And it takes 1 million copies to go platinum in the US and it only takes 300,000 to go platinum in the UK. So it's like, you know, five times platinum. 17 million records worldwide. Shit. There was a time when they said something along the lines like 1 in 5 people in England had a copy of Tubular Bells. Huh. And it was like one of those things where you went to somebody's house. And I remember like my, you know, my parents were, this was a huge record when my parents were old enough that I remember them, you know, as a child. And I remember going to people's houses and everybody was playing fucking Tubular Bells.
Kind of avant-garde. That's amazing.
Oh yeah. For a record that doesn't have any vocals, that does all this completely insane shit. It's a huge accomplishment. And then, you know, like the things that pumps new life into it, especially in the States, is The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And it's insane that this record is almost 50 minutes long and it's only 2 minutes of it that appear, if that, in The Exorcist. But the enormous amount of sales that he got off of just that. And I just love the thought of like people buying this record because of The Exorcist theme song and then listening to it and not fucking getting it at all.
Yeah.
Because it, you know what I'm saying? Like it's not a song. It's not a record. It's this sort of, it's honestly, it's like a tone poem because sides one and side two are completely different. I'm a huge fan of side one. Like side one is the masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. Side two is interesting, but I don't think it's nearly as clever as side one. But just the idea of people buying this thing and then like sitting in their houses and putting the needle down on it and then it doing this 25 minutes. Yeah. I wonder how many people, I wish you got like the Netflix thing of like when they stopped listening.
Yeah.
Like how many people made it all 25 minutes of side one or stopped right after the Exorcist bit.
And then 2 minutes in.
The weird voice comes in, there's like a whole peculiar thing that happens where the he got hammered and he speaks in this crazy voice. I mean, it is a fucking amazing, amazing record. If you haven't listened to it in its entirety, you absolutely should. It is the, what was the other? There was another useless fact. Oh yes. Half the instruments they used were borrowed from a John Cale session and John Cale had hired the Tubular Bells, but never used them. And Mike Oldfield saw them and was like, can I grab those? Would you mind? And he was like, yeah, just take them. I'm never going to fucking use them. So the Tubular Bells being used on this thing was like some accident because John Cale had rented Tubular Bells and then decided not to use them.
Yeah.
Is he aware that somebody's using it for a movie like The Exorcist at the time? Like, is he aware when it's first happening? He has no say over that, right?
He had no idea. I mean,
so
he was
a total accident.
It's a complete, like, it's like one of those things that if you put it into a movie, it's like, to me, it's proof that aliens are right in the experience of being a human being for their own edification. If you put it into a movie, nobody would believe it.
Yeah.
Because first off, you wouldn't believe that a 19-year-old kid could pull this off.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that you could believe that a 19-year-old child would have been able to have all of this in his brain. Like, the whole thing was written in his mind before it hit the paper in this language that he created that then he had to show other people how to translate because he played played everything himself. Hmm. It's so nuts. But there was another – there was another useless – I love useless musical trivia. There was another piece of useless trivia about where it sits. Oh, yeah. So here we go. So it got the 1975 Grammy for the best instrumental composition, which it absolutely should have. It did 280 weeks in the UK charts. 280 weeks is a huge amount of time to have a record in the charts. It's the 42nd best-selling album of all time. The number one selling album of all time is Queen's Number Ones.
As it should be.
As it should be. Do you know what the number 29 best-selling album of all time in the UK is?
What's that? 29?
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
It is the Spice Girls.
Oh, I was going to say Chubba Wubba. I didn't. Well,
that would have been a single, not an album. But yeah, the Spice Girls debuted as number 29, which is awful.
Wow.
That whole album, the Chubba Wubba album.
I wonder if it's
that.
The horror theme thing in the top 50.
Only a horror themed thing. Thriller has got to be up there.
Dark Side of the Moon is number 7.
Okay.
So
that's as it should be. That's a huge weed. So when they came to him and said they want to use the music in the movie, he actually turned it down. And the reason he turned it down was because the movie was too scary.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to have his music used in a movie that was that scary.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is how sensitive a flower Michael Field is that he doesn't want to have his movie used, his music moved in this movie because it's too scary. And it's the thing that might have sold more records than anything else outside of the UK, because this actually came out in the UK, I believe, like before the movie did. So it was already a huge hit because there was a DJ in England called John Peel, who is passed on since, but he has always been and will continue forever to be the guy that introduced more music in the UK than anybody else. Like if you did a John Peel session, you were going to be famous. Yeah. So John Peel was obviously this is right up his fucking alley. So he was a huge fan of this, and that was one of the reasons that it hit the zeitgeist in the UK. But it wasn't The Exorcist, and I think The Exorcist is the reason that it did so well in the States, was because there was, you know, you didn't have that here. You didn't have a voice who would, like Wolfman Jack was Detroit and Chicago and those places, right? So you didn't have like a national voice who would tell you what to listen to and what was musically important. We also had things like the Old Grey Whistle Test, which was a really cool TV show that showed groundbreaking artists, and Top of the Pops was our sort of like half an hour of MTV on a Thursday night from 7 to 8:30, whenever it was. So it took the movie for this to break in the States, which is would have been a crime if Mike Oldfield had his way and not had the fucking thing used, because he was, and also like what the fuck would Tangerine Dream have sounded like?
Yeah, I know.
You think about it now, it's like this is the sound of The Exorcist. Like it's so crazy. Like to like, there's so few times when a piece of music is this indelibly linked. To a movie, you know, like
the only thing bigger would be this, the Blades in Psycho, the rant.
I would have said Jaws
is huge.
Those pieces that are the creature, they are the knife.
But I mean, Halloween is straight from this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that Carpenter probably heard this piece of music. He's like, oh, I could do something kind of this 5/4.
It's sort of like the everyman version, like the time signature, even like it's like a fucking moron level jazzy time signature. We're like, I'll do it at 5/4 instead of 9/48 or whatever, you know, Mike Oldfield did it in.
Right.
And the whole idea of Tangerine Dream, like, would never have been able to pull off anything nearly as creepy as this.
Yeah.
You know, like the sex on the train theme from
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Yeah,
that's also one of my favorite musical segments in a movie, is that is absolutely perfect.
Well, and it's he didn't try to make it creepy. That's what's so interesting.
Right.
This is a piece of music being interpreted as creepy
too,
because of the context you place it in.
Exactly.
Which is really interesting. Yeah.
It becomes scarier than it was intended simply because of the fact that, but it's like, it really is. There's nothing else that you could have.
Right, that's the kind of thing you could imagine another mind, a more generic director, would have put the some toss to the nose,
right,
or something,
right.
And it would have been on the nose.
Yeah. Right,
he's a man of God. Here's the devil, you know. It's,
but instead,
this ethereal, almost angelic.
Yep.
You could almost see it as angels, even though we think of it as kind of evil. But it seems almost angelic.
Well, what's fun is, like, right, because I know the theme first, and then I went back to the piece of music, and I'd always considered it scary. And then when I heard the original, right as we're coming up now, like a minute in, I'm like, oh, this isn't scary at all.
No, it's actually beautiful.
So, yeah, all these layers keep getting added, and you're like, oh, this is actually an incredible piece of music.
So the first time that I actually heard more than just this opening, and I had to pull it up to make sure that I was remembering it correctly, was the 90s. There was this CD released here called Pure Moods.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was huge.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents had that, and I can best describe it as like music you get pedicures to.
Yep.
And it was like a lot of Enigma and Enya, but it had the Twin Peaks soundtrack, or the Twin Peaks like
Julie
main
Cruz.
Song,
yeah.
the Julie Cruz song. And then it also had Tubular Bells on it. And Tubular Bells even though it gets beautiful, it still stuck out like a sore thumb on the album, because you're like listening to an Enya and Enigma and then this.
And then this shows up.
It was just weird. But I remember that was the first time that I was like, oh, there's more
to
it.
So it went into mainstream pop culture. That's what you're saying.
No,
like mainstream houses. You know?
It really became like a separate thing. And the thing is that even on the I remember that they do, they even put out a follow-up called Pure Mutes 2, I believe. And you're right. It was like every chic, you know, back rub spot in the world. Yep. Not to have it play. And, you know, but even on that, they didn't go the whole thing. They didn't put all 20 minutes on it. It was like edited out before the weird shit gets in.
Yeah.
Because we're like 2 minutes already, and Mike hasn't even fucking unleashed any of the hounds. I mean, it's just...
But even like those little piercing kind of jabs that you're getting.
That's the part that reminds me of Goblin so much. Of Claudius Simonetti. It feels like he just listened to this.
He might as well be screaming witch.
Yeah. It's kind of wild.
We were like 2 minutes and 30 seconds in. And now the whole loop starts again.
Longer you listen, the sadder it becomes. They're saying sad. Like, I started thinking about Linda Bear, a little girl possessed. That made me kind of sad.
Yeah,
the music has an inevitability.
It's winsome, for sure.
But yeah. I want to do a psychological study of how he does not find it creepy. Because those musical jabs, those, like, the music
stabbing.
Kind of
like stingers.
Yep. And how it works against 4/4 timing.
Nope.
I mean, it seems like everything he is doing is trying to set us off kilter.
And it's also, as an Englishman, it's a very, very, very English record. Like, this is a journey through Middle Earth. You know, like, there's nothing American about it. Like, that's one of the things that I think didn't work in America until it became the Exorcist theme, is because the only way to, if you stood in front of Stonehenge, you know why Mike Oldfield did Tubular Bells. If you're an American, you would never be able to understand what this, like, all of this.
Yeah, it's almost more Wicker Man.
Yeah.
It's more pastoral. I could see that.
You know, it's like,
that would be good at the ending of Wicker Man, actually.
Yeah, actually, it would.
It'd suit it.
So this is the end of the first movement, one might say. Because it comes out of this, and then it just instantly goes into... Like, how did you do that? I think we're overdriving your
how's it sounding on your end, Dirty?
I think your preamps are getting beaten up by that thing. It puts out very high.
I also really want to know what he was thinking while composing all this, because usually when you look at, like, famous compositions, you know, there's always a story to be told, and any time that there's kind of a shift in the movement,
right?
You know, or even, like, if you look at a classical piece like the Moldau, it's about the river, and the movements in it follow the river, and it makes sense, and you listen to it and go, oh, I get it, it's the river.
Yeah, this is literally called Opus 1.
I have no idea what the fuck is going on here.
It's like, let's just, how much can you fit in, like, all of this shit?
Do we know what his musical influences were?
No one even knows what he's into. Like, that's why I'd love to do I'd love to do a documentary on this and actually have him talk about it. But he's so reticent to be seen and spoken to. They did one on BBC that was mediocre, to say the least. But
yeah, this part.
Like, how do you do that change?
Spring
though? Like,
just
how
came,
do you go
and
from...
I don't know why. It's
Father Marin's just slow dance movement.
But, like, the idea of, like, that's... So now we're at 5 minutes. So in those last 5 minutes, we've done those two huge segments, and then it comes to this bit. And listen to this, how the time changes. So you got all these loops. The guitar is obviously the most present. And then out of that... It's incredible, man. Like, just that one change alone, if you pulled that off, you'd be like, all right, you get a fucking Grammy for that. But the fact that we're only at the 5.5 minute mark, and he pulls that off, and this piano.
And that's when Linda Blair's stabbing herself with the cross. That's music.
Precisely.
That would be amazing. Thought,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, and then it's so innocent. Though.
And then this bit. Just a, you know... I'm telling you, it's
And is that him playing?
Yeah, everything. Oh my gosh. Except for the bass guitar. His bass line is... And then right here.
Yeah, Goblin got their whole...
The whole thing.
Their whole act for missing.
I want to direct this guy with some Eddie just talking about what he stole here.
Like, hey. This is played by a 19-year-old kid.
In case you forgot, you're listening to the theme from The Exorcist.
Yeah.
This is still it.
Yeah.
It really is.
This is 6 minutes in. And the same thing. Seven-minute mark, the next piece happens.
What instrument is this?
There's so much effect going on. Like, I think it's some sort of guitar. It's been, like, a bass guitar that's been beaten to shit with reverb and some sort of overdrive. But there's clearly more than one thing happening.
That actually sounds a little bit like Eyes Wide Shut. That theme's on. Oh,
yeah, that's got a Kubrick thing going.
Yeah, this is the kind of record that you would imagine Stanley would have been huge fan
editing
of.
Editing too, yeah.
But like, what is this theme that's completely... And the other thing that's crazy, like when you listen to it in its entirety, and then you... Out of nowhere.
Well, that's a whole new song.
It's a whole new song. And the thing is, there's no drums holding any of it together. There's no beat. The drums don't come in until the second side is when he brings drums in finally. The whole side one has no drums in it at all.
And it still is not 4/4. Like,
nope.
You can't clap your hands
nope.
to this shit.
Yeah. Can't do it at all for the entire thing. That's why side two is a little... But it's completely Middle Earthy and English... And, like, where did you start? You know what I'm saying? Like, what's the first instrument that you played in order to be able to build everything on top of it? Because there doesn't seem to be anything root holding it together. Let's not forget, it started.
Yeah.
That's what's fucking mind-blowing about it. It starts there, and then by, you know, the eight-minute mark, you're at this, and then this bit.
Maybe that's kind of like the movie, though. The movie starts with him getting out of a cab, and it's playing that... part
that
of the
thing.
Music, and then it goes utterly bonkers by the end. The same way, like
same
you
thing.
Know. So it's he had the trajectory down.
No, I'm on his page on iTunes right now, and I'm seeing obviously this version is 1973. There's the deluxe edition from 2009. There's Tribute Bells 2. There's
yep.
Part 3.
Yep.
What do you think of these other re-recordings of it? I mean, obviously they don't handle the original, but
they're horrible.
Really?
Yeah, because the thing is that what happens is that he goes down a rabbit hole of trying to get this thing perfect, and that was the thing that was allowed to happen with MIDI, like when he finally got to do it on computer music instruments. And it sucks all of the humanity out of it. And once that comes out of it, and the story isn't as good because it's not one kid playing this all himself. It's now a dude who's allowed to loop things and make them perfect and not have them...
CGI. It's the difference
exactly.
between the guy in the suit and the CGI.
It's the difference between, you know, Star Wars with models, which inherently have a humanity to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And inherently, when you see them, are like an organic thing. To no matter how fucking good that CGI is, it's never going to have any humanity to it because it hasn't been built by a human being. It's the same exact thing with this. That's sort of the irony of it is that the more precise it becomes and the more times he does it, the less of the original intent it was. Because it's like, dude, you fucking nailed it on the first one. You know, like you did it. And it's really sad that it really is like this great white whale. Like he can't stop fucking with it. Like he has to keep going back and each iteration is further away. That's why the 25th anniversary one is the only one that I'll have any truck with because there were sort of, you know, like 1973 technology, especially in the mastering process. This version of it sounds so much better than the original. You can hear all of the detail. I think the 25th anniversary is on the iTunes. It's the silver. The silver covered one.
There's one from 2009.
That might be
digital deluxe edition.
Of
but
course. I mean, everything has to be at this in this day and age.
It's got new stereo mixes and stuff.
Yes,
is that it?
Yeah, yeah. The stereo mixes are so much better too.
Yeah, this is pretty crazy.
So you heard this album before you saw The Exorcist as a kid?
Yeah, I didn't, dude. I don't. This is why Brian Bettino hates me. So I'm friends with Brian Bettino, who obviously did Strangers, and he keeps like he comes to my shows. He like sits at my house, and I'll show him a bunch of shit, and he's always like, "When are you gonna watch my movie, man?"
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm never gonna watch your fucking movie because everybody I know, I'm always like, "What's the scariest movie you ever seen?" It's like at least in the top three where they'll be like, "Oh, dude, fuck that. You ever see The Strangers?" I'm like, "No! Like, I'm never gonna see The fucking Strangers because it sounds horrifying."
But you've seen The Exorcist, right?
I have seen The Exorcist.
So what was your reaction the first time you heard that music in that context, given that you already knew the music? Because most of us are first interaction.
Yeah, like heard The Exorcist and then...
That's a good question. It was one of those sort of things where it didn't quite make sense because the whole thing to me had always had a context that was completely different to that, right? Yeah, so my context of it is sitting in my dad's living room, you know, my parents' living room or my house with the headphones on listening to it, and it's sort of being this mind-blowing expansion of my genetic DNA as music knowledge. And to then see it like in this context, it's also perfect.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't, like you'd watch it and you're like, oh dude, it's the perfect piece of music for that moment. Like there's nothing else that you could have used.
It's so mysterious.
It's so mysterious.
It's a dark figure coming out and walking towards a house with a
with
spotlight.
That. And that's his, that's like, it's his soundtrack. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like that sort of thing. Like
he is the exorcist. Yeah, he's the guy.
He leaves the house and that plays every time he leaves. And it really is like the perfect, especially as you dig deeper and deeper into side one and you hear it expand and get bigger and bigger and it becomes, you know, there's this evil, like it's really crazy because there is the I forget the name of him. There's a name for the voice that he got hammered on and did this overdubbed voice later on, which sounds like a demon. Mm.
So he actually added in vocals at some point.
There is a vocal, but it's him. I wish I fucking knew where it was. This would have been good preparation. But there is, there's this weird. Oh yeah, this part.
That sounds like a giallo, like an Italian.
Yeah,
like
it totally does sound.
It's like the whole Italian soundscape came from this song.
Which is kind of rad. Yeah. I want that lecture as well. Like, how did giallo come from this song?
Now I'm glad I got the mustache. It fits.
Yeah, you nailed it. Is it here?
That's...
Oh, I'm telling you, man. All right. Oh, the bells.
Oh, yeah, it feels
are
like
these the tubular bells?
No.
Oh.
Not yet.
Just the bells.
Not yet. Hold on.
Oh, here, this might be it. So listen to this voice that he uses. This is Mike Oldfield. This is so fucking nuts, I'm telling you. So this is the beginning of the tubular bell section.
Sounds like the deep red.
So goblin.
Hope Fried gets left alone.
But like, think about this being played live.
Yeah,
you'd have to have somebody who's willing to sit there and just go and play these perfectly.
Yeah,
I'm also intrigued how they're keeping pace because there isn't pace.
It's him. It's not even they. It's him playing to himself, and it just keeps building. And when you hear it on a decent system.
So what is he saying?
He said Glockenspiel.
Glockenspiel.
So that's his Viv Stanchel. I have to find the... I think it might be on... Let me find... This is side two, which is not as good. I don't think it's as good. I'll find the voice, the demon voice, which is weird because... Yeah, here we go. So this is...
Ooh, I like that. That's cool.
This is the drums.
That sounds...
Oh, that's right. Ramstein calling.
Yeah.
So what is he saying?
No idea. Nobody knows. He created this language.
Which he wrote the music in this language.
Yeah.
Do we know if he did a lot of drugs?
No.
In that time. Really? This just came out of... Then he's a mad genius.
Yeah.
It's the same language William Shatner speaks in that one movie where it's the language you made up for the movie.
It's he made up this language, and I forget the name, but it's like Windshoal Man or something, and it's like he created this like sort of fictional character that he created.
But that does sound like a Pazuzu thing. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
The weird connections.
Have you ever seen him live? I mean, has he toured a lot or anything, or no?
He's never... He's...
And that's so different than their thing.
Yeah. Like, this is why side two is like, I'm not as big a fan.
Yeah.
But.
Now I want to break down his language.
Right?
I mean, like, if this is the language that he created specifically to match this song, I feel like there's going to be just
Becca.
As much.
Everyone knows it's Klingon.
Not quite.
Well, this is why I want...
Like, although it does have the same guttural sound.
Yeah. I want to do a documentary on it, because to have him actually explain why each of these, what each of these pieces mean, because they're not even like separately titled on the record. Mm-hmm. It's just... Part one and part two. So it's an entire 24, you know, like, and in the CD world, they could have like marked each piece, like, you know, and as it goes by, it's like section one is called this, section two is called this. But he doesn't. None of it has any titles. So the whole thing was conceived as one huge piece.
Opus.
That's all. Or, you know, Breakfast in Bed if you're fucking.
Opus in Bed.
Opus in
Much
bed.
Better.
Tubular Opus in Bed. Yeah. But I love the. Let me see if we can find that. Where Viv Stanchel introduces the tubular bells. And the cool thing is... Man. Mandolin. Like he's saying... And Viv Stanchel is shit-faced when he's doing his violin. Like that. Two slightly distorted.
It's very,
it's very
British.
Specific.
So British.
Yeah, that's great.
Two slightly... So these themes are like, when you really listen to this thing, this whole section here, like the last 10 minutes of it, is all of these repeating themes. And then
Mandolin.
Also played by Mike Oldfield.
Do you know how hard it is to play a mandolin? I cannot believe
like
that he would just pick one up and be like, oh yeah, I can play
Got
this.
It. Never took a lesson in my life. How hard could it be?
And now the music is the ending of the crawl.
Smash guitar and introducing acoustic guitar.
And then there it is.
Were those brief vocals?
It's a choir made up of him and the rest of the people that worked at the manor, which is even crazier. So I think this is when they when the tubular bells kick in. This is another one of those things, if you put it in a movie, nobody would believe it. Like, it wasn't called Tubular Bells when Viv Stanchel announces Tubular Bells.
Yeah.
Like, it's this fucking pronouncement of this moment as if it was already the title of this piece. And instead, it's just this hammered lead singer of this band called the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band is actually the name of the fucking band. So this madman, you know, like... appears out of nowhere and then claims this title from the ether because he felt that this was the
Tubular Bells.
And then the fact that this wasn't the original Tubular Bells. And then it's like the Greco-Roman Gregorian singing in the background, which is so exorcist-ish, you know, it's like the whole church thing. Complete happenstance.
Whereas side two is all exorcist too. that's where it all goes.
Well, it was interesting. I was online looking up exorcist stuff today just to make sure I had all my facts straight, and there was a sub thread that was all talking about actually one of my favorite horror movies, which is Exorcist 3.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that. It was on our top 100 last week.
We all love it.
It's like the least appreciated. Like, nobody gave a fuck about that thing. And it's so good.
So you have seen Exorcist 3. You're allowed to
stay. I've seen Exorcist 1 and I've seen Exorcist 3. I didn't watch Exorcist 2 because I...
Terrible.
You can skip that one.
Okay.
It's okay.
But Exorcist 3 is like one of those that I kept going back to. And I'll say one of the biggest fucking scares of my life is... when that fucking thing darts across the back of the hallway.
Yeah. I was like, what the greatest? Fuck? So you can break down like the music, how the musicality of it works. When I teach, I use that scene, like every single bit of minutia that goes into making that the greatest jump scare ever.
It's the greatest jump scare of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It still works. I remember a couple of years, I've said it on the show before.
Yeah, like I've seen it a bunch of times and it gets me every time.
Mm-hmm. Every time. And I show it to like older, you know, because sometimes it's your age that scares you. But I show it to friends my age that had never seen it before recently. And that moment always gets them.
The time, the pacing on it
works as well as it does.
Insane. Who directed that?
That was William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel.
The writer of the first one.
Yeah, the writer of the novel.
Oh, he directed that?
Yeah. Which is why you get some really good kind of more talky moments that I feel like it would have been cut out, like the carp discussion, and there's the whole thing of bringing the penguin to the hospital. You would never get those discussions.
Who's that main guy? Who's the main dude?
George C. Scott.
George C. Scott.
It makes you feel better. A British guy directed part two.
I'm not sure it does.
So it's not a reason to go back and watch. Do not feel compelled.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen it, the TV series that they did recently was really good. Stellar.
Was it really?
Really stellar.
Yeah.
Which is it all of them in one TV series, or is it the first one as a TV?
Well, they did two seasons, and technically, mild spoiler, I guess, but it's its own thing.
Okay.
But then halfway through season one, they're like, nope, this is connected to everything. And you're like, cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, their winner is, I think it's in the first episode of both seasons. They end with Tubular Bells, and you're like,
do they really?
Yeah, the second season is even less connected, but I liked it better.
But it's even better, and it's of course canceled because we can't have nice things.
No, we definitely need the Hawaii 5-0 reboot more than we would need that.
Exactly.
So who's the other character in the third one? The other old guy. There's a scene in the coffee shop or in a restaurant with
his cop friend who's like, priest. The priest. The priest who's dying
is fucking...
Their scenes are amazing.
Amazing.
Really great.
Together,
just two old guys hanging out talking about stuff. I love it, yeah.
Talking about stuff, but it's like... it's
And he's into movies. He's into like movies and stuff. Yeah, the other guy's great.
It's a wonderful life.
No, I should go back and rewatch that because that with the fucking scene with the head choppery things.
It's just such a subtle scene too, but it's one of the ones that gets me. It's the woman on the ceiling.
Yes.
It's quick, it's subtle, and barely even like acknowledged, but
that's interesting.
It gets me every time.
And it's still being recycled in a movie that we've been talking about today somewhat earlier.
It's really, if you haven't seen that, you should definitely see part three because I was like one of those. I was like, I think I even have it. I had it on a video cassette, and a friend of mine gave it to me, and I was like, I had nothing to do, and I put it in, and then it just became like one of my go-to films because just
well. What
brilliant.
What horror stuff do you like? Because I know before we talked off air, you told me John Carpenter's The Thing is one of your favorites, but that's kind of like I think everyone unanimously agree.
You can't have that.
You didn't
question. It says more about you than it does about The Thing.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, like the heart. I don't. Life is already terrifying enough for me as is, you know, like, but I was explaining to Rob that like, and his mustache, we had a conversation.
Is that not the greatest stash
at
you've
the same
ever
time,
seen?
You had a conversation.
It was like a threesome.
Where do your eyes rest? Which part of Rob does it go on the mustache?
Straight to the mustache.
Mine's on the handlebar, the slight curve.
Dude, I get these, I was watching a bunch of Charlie Bronson movies from the late 70s and I'm like, I like that look. I'm going to.
Yeah, but the thing is, you could go further.
You could also, you could bring the burns out a little.
You could go YMCA further if you wanted to. There's always that far.
We'll see.
I used to play in a joke metal band, and I did the thing where you shave just the middle bit, so you have the handlebar mustache that joins the side. And then I had this, and my girlfriend at the time, she lived in San Francisco, so I hadn't seen it for the week that I shaved it. And when she, when I met her at the airport, she was like, "There's no fucking way. Like, if that stays, you're not getting laid." And I was like, "Then I'm not getting fucking laid. I'll take a long distance relationship with this mustache and beard combo." So life is terrifying enough for me as is without getting the shit scared out of you. But I was talking to Rob about that. Like, I'm also obviously knowing Brian, I would then know Adrian Biddle, who is Brian's partner, did The Monster and all that stuff. So I've watched all of their movies, which has been really cool to sort of, but what's been more interesting is realizing that genre movies, in quotes, as they call them, I believe, there was like the symbolism behind everything. Yeah. I didn't get that. Like, I was talking to Rob about when I watched the Oz Perkins movie.
Black Hood's Daughter of February, yeah, as we saw
February,
now.
Which is like to watch that thing.
That's right, because they produced it.
They produced it. So to get to watch that thing come together, like I read the script, and then to watch Perkins, you know, make this thing happen, and then finding out, you know, that it was, I didn't realize it was him. Yeah. And then I didn't realize that, like, not only, you know, obviously we all know about his dad, but I didn't realize that his mom had fucking died in the world. It wasn't in the World Trade. She was in one of the planes.
Yeah, the plane that hit. Yeah, it's total tragedy.
The level of tragedy, like, I don't even know how you, like, it's enough that you've been raised and your dad is Tony, and it's the fucking psycho guy, and then he died, and it's AIDS and fucking closeted, that whole sub, like, whatever that storyline. And then to have your mom die in an even more specific manner that only a few human beings on the planet can even remotely identify with that experience. So then when I was talking to her and she was telling me about that, and that's what he was working through with the movie, when I went back and watched it again, I was like, holy shit. So that's the whole thing about horror that I never really understood, was the fact that those directors were using it as a means to talk about other, I just thought they were trying
to get over what you were just, you're saying you don't want to watch it because the world's so horrible. I think a lot of people want to use it because the world's so horrible.
Right, exactly. You know, like,
and
this
way to cope.
There's like people like me that watch Tommy Boy, and then there's people, there's people like you that watch horror. You know, it's like never the twain shall meet. Yeah.
But again, when we talked about this on the phone, what we get out of horror movies in that sense and work through our own things, that's what you see in music. And that's what's special about what you do. And, you know, I should mention that normally the version of this that you do, you have all the elements separated.
Yes.
So you're able to play them one at a time.
Yeah.
I mean, God knows if you ever got these separated.
If I was ever allowed to do that, one of my goals is to become so known for this that would be an option.
That he'd want you to do it. Yeah.
Either sit with Mike Oldfield or just be given the stuff and get to tell the record. I did actually do... I used to do a session where, like, a little VIP thing with like 50 people, where I would do what I would call an album screening, where I'd talk about a record that I was a big fan of and then play the record and then reward everyone for attending by doing a session breakdown that I hadn't done yet. Like, I did this one and then did Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, which was epic. But it was really fucking awesome to be able to tell people the story of this record. And then I didn't needle drop like we did here. I just sat back and just let it play and darkened the room and just had the visualizer up on the screen in the middle of the thing and just watched 50 people's fucking heads come off and getting to hear it loud on a massive PA and really be able to understand just how an incredible journey of an experience this album is. And if you listen to it on earbuds, you're an asshole. If you're listening to
you're like David Lynch at the iPad or whatever.
Yeah, or if you're listening to it on the speakers on your find a friend with a decent stereo and just please listen to it in front of that, because it really is, it's a screening. Like, when you watch this movie that is this album play out in front of you and realize, you know, the characters that it took to do it in this one genius 19-year-old kid. I mean, the record comes out when he's 20. Is fucking unbelievable, dude. And the window into a genius mind. And it is. You're right. Like, I hadn't even thought about it in, like, the Kubrick version of it. Like, it really does end up becoming, you know, it's his.
Somebody who needs to find a way to will something into existence, even though they don't have the skills to do it. So they have to find a way to will it.
And then to hear it, and for you as a listener to hear it and think, holy shit, that's a fucking stroke of genius. It's amazing. It's perfect. And to have them hear nothing but the warts.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that he regrets that the tubular bell aren't the originals that they recorded, and like it genuinely causes him pain that he got his entire vision out.
Yeah, it's his continuity error.
Right, like, except for this. Like, he's wearing a red shirt when the other scene he was wearing a black shirt. Yeah. You know, just fucking drives him nuts.
Yeah.
So it's been a really cool experience to hang out with someone and have in your life a friendship with somebody who sees, you know, like Bertino told me, I don't remember which one it was. I didn't know him when he was doing Strangers, so I forget what script it was that he was working on, but he said that when he killed off the main character, he wept.
Yeah,
and I was like, you big pussy. Like, what the just a fucking story. And he was like, no. And I thought about it. Like, of course not. Over the course of however long it takes you to write that story, you become connected.
Yeah.
You know, and Brian's a really sensitive guy, and his story has its own layers of tragedy and sadness built into it. And he's also, you know, like covered in tattoos of the ways that you can be killed. I'm like, who the fuck does
it's
that?
Fascinating.
To
I mentioned like, this
Becca
on
loves
the break.
The tattoos.
I love his tattoos. I've never even,
I think
I've only met him once at a film festival like 10 years ago when Strangers was coming out. But I just remember being fascinated by his arms, like not in like a weird way, but just in like, you know, there's a story.
Yeah. And there's no
and
order.
I want to see, like, I want to
so
have
Becca
a conversation.
His
just about his tattoos.
I'll be like, you got to go in, but you can't wear a shirt.
Yeah,
the whole
there you
time.
Go.
Rebecca's saying, we'll score it to Tubular Bells. Like, we'll go
but
in
it's,
harmony.
They're totally sporadic. Like, there's no, like, there's a lot of, obviously, I'm anal retentive and Asperger's, so mine are completely with the order. His are just like fucking, it's almost like he was held down by some fucking tribesman and just covered in ways that you can be killed. I'm like, this is the strangest fucking tattoo art ever.
And usually with most, I'll say, people in the horror community, I can immediately look and go, oh, well, that was inspired by Maniac or that was inspired by Tourist Trap. I had no idea where some of his shit came from. Like, I want to have conversations with him about the art and why
he's got like
he
two chainsaws and an X pattern.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and then there's like a noose and a gun. And
that
at least
could be Texas Chainsaw 2 when they're fighting with could the
have
two
been.
Chainsaws.
Maybe.
With
probably wasn't.
But see, I want to ask. I want to be like, why that and why there?
He's definitely had, you know, like his life has had its level of tragedy and, you know, as a musician, it's very, you know, it's like an easy thing to be like, okay, you're just working through your tragedies with your music, like lyrically, even if you're not addressing it lyrically. So the idea of like making horror movies that are translating another experience either the director has had or the writer has had into a form that is completely unrelated to the actual thing that you're watching was like, I was like, holy shit, like Oz Perkins is working through that shit with February, as it was called when I read it and saw it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a much better title.
Yeah, we all agree.
We all agree.
Still, I feel, again, it's a different, when you change something, the alchemy's off. It's like February in that film feels
February.
Like the thing
feels it.
That you made.
Yeah.
And then when you change it to something else, you're like, I don't know what that means now. And I feel it's just interesting.
Still February to us.
Yeah, and it was February to me too. I mean, because it became Black Coat's Daughter, like, after we'd seen it a million times and it was done and we were like, oh, it's fucking February, and we'd all talked, and the one of the things I really loved about it was that Oz had wanted every scene to be a photograph.
Yeah.
And if you took a still frame of every frame in that movie, it's a fucking photograph. Like when that car's on fire in the parking lot and you're like, I want that blown up to like a 10-foot by 8-foot thing and hanging in a fucking wall in my apartment, because every single shot, like the DP did such a gorgeous job on it. And that was one of the movies that I watched. And even though it had some scarier moments, it obviously is not remotely as close to The Strangers, thank God, because I wouldn't have been able to sit through it. But I can't really be scared a lot, and I don't like gore, so I can't go with like the slasher porn thing, you know, like that always scared the bejesus out of me, because I have a very sensitive side to myself, which is why, you know, I'm glad that I ended up looking the way I do, because if I looked the way I feel, I'd probably be a significantly more fey-looking human being, and the world would have been infinitely more miserable for me. But the thing I loved, because it's just perfect.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like,
also beautiful music to that.
Music is fucking gorgeous. And I was like, for some reason, when I was a kid coming up, all of his movies resonated with me, like the Big Trouble in Little China all of those. And Kurt Russell, I was so stoked. I went to see Big Trouble in Little China, and Kurt Russell was there at the Egyptian Theater. Did you go to that?
Yeah.
No, there was Beyond Fest one. Yeah.
At Beyond Fest with Carp. No, I wasn't at that. I was when he played live downtown.
That thing must have been fucking awesome.
Yeah, his live show is incredible.
So that seems like a segue to my dream.
Oh, yeah.
I have a dream.
He's got to ask you a question, and I swear that I did not put him up to this.
Now, this is a dream I had for a long time.
Of everyone in the room, he's not familiar with your show for the most part.
Okay,
so, ready for it? Here it goes. This is why I had to do a live on air.
Okay. The greatest musician ever is the greatest drum player of all time, which is Phil Perka. Phil Collins, sorry.
Yeah.
So, Phil Collins. Okay, here's my dream. You ready for this?
I didn't tell him that, by the way.
Okay, so I have a dream. The only reason I thought of you to bring this up to is because you know how to isolate elements, and I don't know how to. So, most people make these YouTube clips. I've never had an interest in that, but one day I woke up and I thought to myself, oh my God, if I could isolate the vocals of Phil Collins singing In the Air Tonight, and if I could lay that over Carpenter's Halloween score, and ooh, then if I could cut clips of their all the films together, like Jamie Lee waking up and I remember, and have flashes through all the movies, and then Michael Myers slowly, and almost like a love theme of the two coming together. But the haunting way he sings those opening songs, and the way the soundtrack initially starts slower, I think those two things would be the most beautiful piece of music. But I don't know how to make it, and that's why I've come to you.
Yes,
I've come to you.
You can actually do that. It would be possible to get the vocal out of that song,
especially probably that part, like at least the start. I just want to even just hear the two things together for a moment to go, am I right?
Or are you talking about wrong? Are you talking about the Laurie Strode theme, or like, because not the Halloween theme, like the not the din, 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 din. You're like, din, no, din,
yeah, the slower, yeah, yeah.
You're like but, that but thing.
I'm open to whatever. As long as Phil Collins, as long as Buster is involved, part of this,
You could, I think you could probably get it out enough to be able to put it over the top of something.
And then I could go, okay, so if that, you know.
But you are correct. He is one of the great. It's like people always bust my balls about Phil Collins, and I'm like, okay, cool. So here's the thing. Name me your favorite band. Cool, great. Do they have a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame? No. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Do they have an Oscar? No. All right, cool. Have they had a musical on Broadway? No, they haven't done that either. Have they invented a word that became part of the fucking cultural zeitgeist around the world?
What word is this?
Sussudio.
Sussudio.
It doesn't exist. It's not a real thing.
How about, have they been a bad guy in Miami Vice? Because unless it's Leonard Cohen, you better take a seat.
You haven't done that either. I actually just listened to, it's been great. So, a person gave me as a gift the Phil Collins Not Dead Yet, which is the name of his autobiography, because it's Phil and he's so self-referential. But it's him reading his own autobiography, and I've been listening it in my house, which has been great, because if I close my eyes, it was like Uncle Phil was sitting in the corner reading the story to me the whole time, which was really nice. To sort of like hear him start to list all of the things over the course of the story that he has actually done, and you're like, holy shit, like, even as a huge fan, I didn't know that. And there was a great meme going around that was like, Phil Collins went hard in the paint on the Tarzan theme song. He didn't need to do that for us or whatever it was. And it's like my least favorite. You know, he does sort of, he loses his shit a little bit towards the end of his career. There's no doubt about it. But those first three Phil records are, everyone should own those, man.
Yes, you are listening to Shockwaves, our podcast.
Well, it is horror related because we're talking about Halloween and Phil together.
And Phil together, which would bring the two worlds.
And I'm going to just throw this out there. If we do this and we make it, I wouldn't be surprised if Turk ends the movie with that
with
track.
Your version?
Yeah. With my version. He forgets Carpenter doing the original and he just starts Phil Collins.
You just created like 10,000 internet rumors.
Make it happen.
I want the last moment just, and I remember,
our fourth co-host, who is not here, is the producer on the new Halloween movie.
Oh, really?
So maybe we can make it happen.
You never know. And if at worst, like best case scenario, would be that you do it in some dummy mocked up way, and then it gets done for real.
Yeah, and then Phil
by Phil and
Carpenter on stage together.
Right? They should go into
our guys. But I swear to God, this had nothing to do with you coming on, and it has actually weirdly. It was like one of those weird dreams where you're like, oh, that must work. And I have no musical ambitions at all. So there you go.
You could definitely see it. I will attempt to get you that.
It will be a dream come true, sir. And it is good to meet a fellow Phil. Because in New Zealand, I grew up in New Zealand, and that was the biggest band when I was a kid. Everyone loved it, and that's all you heard. Is,
well, I mean,
Genesis,
look,
Phil, you know?
That's the thing, is that there was that period in the, you know, like the mid to late 80s where Phil is killing it in his solo career and also killing it in his band. And he's on television, and he's in every fucking movie. Yeah. And, you know, they're like, it just got to the point where there's so much Phil Collins. And he says in the book, he's like, I just didn't want to say no to everything because everything sounded awesome.
Yeah.
Of course I would want to play with fucking, you know, in England for Live Aid and then fly across in Concord to play in Live Aid in Philadelphia and destroy Led Zeppelin. Of course I would want to do that. And then he played the Against All Odds, and there's a bum note in his the English Against All Odds, and you can see it in his face because it's the worst too, because it's just him at a piano and he fucks the note up because his fingers were so sweaty, and you just see it on his face. He's like, a billion fucking people just fluff that fucking thing, for God's sakes. But Phil is Phil's not to be messed with.
Not to be fucked with.
Yeah, no, I have a. That's my one of my tattoos. This is the cover of the 12-inch of Take Me Home.
Oh, nice.
Which is a guy with a bag on his back and then a little suitcase.
Wow.
Seen
that? Well, Rob will link to your other shows so people can dive all the way into that.
Yes.
How else can people find you?
So the best way to do it, so I do a morning show segment here in Los Angeles on a station called KLOS, and there's a an archive of all of my appearances. I just did Big Country in a Big Country on Monday, which I was pleasantly surprised.
Great.
Everyone else gave a shit about.
Yeah, it was really good.
Because I really went into that, and I was like, I'm only doing this for myself and like three other people on the planet. But I think I got more feedback on that one than any of the others I've ever done. So on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock here in Los Angeles, but then they get archived on a SoundCloud that is linked through my Facebook, I mean, through my website, which is thesessiononair.com. There's also a little EPK that shows you kind of like a little bit of what I do live and ends with my ex-girlfriend calling me a fucking douchebag, which is always something that every fan should be able to say about the person who they've been in a relationship with for 4 years, but you know, I left it in there. So you can see that. And then I'm currently, there'll also be like a calendar of the events that I'm trying to do, because I'm going to be going to San Francisco again. I'm going to Oregon, hopefully in September, to do one of my shows there. And the show live is, it's sort of, it's just me sitting and making up a bunch of shit for 2 hours while I play you the tracks that make up some of the greatest songs of all time.
And there's a visual component to the live show, which is great.
Yeah, I have a TV. Yeah, I bring up the pictures so you can see the players that we're going to be talking about over the course of the hour. And then, you know, like that. But most of the time, it's like a Pro Tools window that has all the waveforms, because I sort of didn't realize that the average person never really gets to see audio turned into a waveform.
Yeah.
So even in that way, it's a thing where people are like, oh, dude, I've never experienced that before.
Now, speaking of crazy tattoos and where they are, what's the waveform on your, or the wave on your arm?
So this is awesome. I'm going to see. The problem is that my friend, so this is the Soundwave tattoo. So
so this is one that like when you die, it will, you this is like forever.
This is, well, it's already forever.
Yeah.
So my friend designed and made this happen. So I told him, I was like, dude, we got to do this and we're going to shoot a video for it. Oh, for fuck's sakes. New phone. Who's this? So let's see if it'll, the problem is
you can scan it and it will play it anywhere,
should,
right?
But this one, see, the problem is that this is this is one of the prototype ones, so it won't, with the right light, yeah, I'm fucking bummed. Because what it does when it works is it Rickrolls you.
Oh, wow, I love that. I've heard people getting like notes from their parents that.
So we're supposed to film a thing because it's so frustrating that it doesn't work because it's really the greatest punchline of all time. So when I saw the video go around that like all the news services and everybody are using, like you can see them all here. And I called him and I was like, dude, we got to fucking Rickroll everybody. And he was like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, what we'll do is we're going to shoot the commercial or the video piece. And I'm going to talk about how my grandfather died and when I was, you know, with him, I spent like the last 2 weeks interviewing him, talking to him, and right before he died, he was like, you know, I was like, what's the secret of fucking life? So he gave it to me, so I had to turn it into a tattoo, and this is it. And then I put it on, and then it fucking Rickrolls everybody. And then, you know, we're going to try and reach out to Rick Astley and have him actually lean in frame and be like, you just got Rickrolled, bitches, because I know and do it. But it's so annoying that it won't trigger because it's the greatest punchline ever that I don't get to show anybody because of the fact that for some reason it, I think the waveform is actually slightly too complicated for it because usually it's people talking, like people get their kids saying, I love you, Dad, or whatever.
Yeah.
So I got to get it redone because otherwise I just have this weird looking thing on my arm and it doesn't do the thing that it's supposed to fucking do, which is kind of fucking annoying because it should, because it's fucking Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up.
Huh. I think you should keep getting it tattooed on your body just like Mike Oldfield keeps trying to
perfect it. Still not working, goddammit.
You're covered in nothing.
But it's a great joke that never pays off. I did the whole thing at a party the other day and did that and it still didn't work.
Didn't work.
Like, God damn it, man. I went a long way for a fucking joke that doesn't pay off.
Well, thank you so much, man, for coming down. And
thank
we really
you.
Appreciate it. And everybody, please check out, I'm going to post links to your SoundCloud so people can check out your show.
Yeah.
Big fan of everything you do, man. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you for
thank
having
you.
Me. And if you're, if you want me to come and do your birthday again, I'll come and do it for you.
Hey, all right.
You have to do from far and me.
Yeah.
A double dip.
You want it? All right. We'll make that happen.
Absolutely. For you, anything.
Yeah. Great.
And
thanks.
And I will do anything if you really do pull off this. Whatever you want. I'm here. Whatever. Take it, man.
I would kill for the air conditioning to get turned back on.
Okay. We can do that.
Much easier than my body. Let's do it.